Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, and a happy holidays to you for whatever holiday you celebrate. And welcome to DC Special Cast, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Paul Ken. This podcast is an exploration of DC's special comics of the Bronze Age, which included such titles as the aptly named DC Special and Special Series, but also DC Superstars, Super DC Giant, Four-Star Superhero Spectacular, and others. If you've read any of these comics, you know they varied wildly in content, quality, and even format. They featured every possible genre of the comics industry at that time. Today, for this very special holiday episode, I am joined by Fire and Water All-Star, my co-host on the sorely missed Batman Family Reunion, my podcasting partner and Bat Brother, Sean M. Myers. Hey, Sean, it's been a year since we ended Batman Family Reunion. Can you believe it? I have missed podcasting with you.
Ho, ho, ho. I wanted to let everybody know, this is an audio podcast, but I literally am wheeling in a six-foot star made entirely of white M&Ms.
Guess what, listeners? Sean's not it.
I'm not it. Yes, I am.
I don't know what I'm going to say. But guess what, listeners? That's not all. To celebrate this 12th episode and first anniversary of DC Special Cast, I decided to make this episode even more special. Sean and I will be handling the beginning of the show and the last story, but in between, past guests from my first year will be covering the various stories with me, including...
the miraculous Ryan Daly, wishing you happy holidays.
Brett Young, and everyone here at the Fantasta Lounge, as we wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Season's greetings from Rob Kelly.
Merry Christmas from Chris and Cindy Franklin and the House of Frankenstein.
And finally, to whet your appetite some more, make sure to stay tuned after the final story for a special announcement from me and Sean. And we're serious this time. But before we go any farther, we need to take a moment to thank our sponsors. This episode of DC Special Cast is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 40% off with free shipping for orders of $50 or more. Sean, you want to tell us what you brought this time?
I have three picks for everybody. So I'm going to be honest. I have three picks. One of them I would love to have, but it's too expensive, so I'm not going to get it for myself. The second one I am going to get, and the third one I always get. So the first up is Michael Golden Marvel Stories Artist Edition Hardcover. And this is a collection of Michael Golden's incredible artwork. And I would love to have this. The reason I'm talking about this is because when I put in Christmas and in stock trades, I went through and I'm like, Michael Golden Christmas, what? This volume has 176 pages. And some of those pages are a Wolverine Christmas story. So that's fantastic. So that's why this is on this list. It's not underneath my tree because it's $97.50. And I understand that I am not allowed to use Patreon money for something like this. So I can't, but I am recommending it. I'm recommending it to everybody because I love Michael Golden. We talked a lot about him on Batman Family. This has a ton of stuff that I don't have. Now there is like a Spider-Man Hulk from Marvel Fanfare 47, and I have that. My second pick, and this one I am really going to get, the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer Island of Misfit Toys original graphic novel. It's 80 pages. It looks fantastic. They look exactly, I mean, they're drawings, but they look exactly like the Rankin-Bass characters. Sam the Snowman is in there. King Moonracer. I just think it looks fantastic, and I am going to get that. And with in-stock trades, I know a lot of people you'll hear our recommendations and that kind of stuff, but I do want to let you know that I really, really, honestly, for real, use in-stock trades every month. I am a huge fan of the DC Finest reprint line. For me, it's very reminiscent of the digest. Like, there were two digests a month, and I never knew what the digests were going to be, but I would get them. Always exposed to like some brand new thing that I never read before. So I am treating the DC Finest like the digests. Now, I'll let you know they're a lot more expensive than the digests, which is why I use in stock trades. First of all of them are like 40, 50, 42% off, all that kind of stuff, which is great. And the cool thing is they come out three a month. I order all three at a time because I'm getting something over $50. I get free shipping. So that's fantastic. So go to the DC Finest page on InStock Trades and you can pick from a ton of great books. Those are my recommendations.
Well said. Well said. Well, I did bring something. I brought Walt Disney's Donald Duck hardcover Christmas box set For those who are looking for something special to give this holiday season, we present this handsome box set, which contains two of the best Christmas stories you'll ever read, Christmas on Bear Mountain, which is the first Uncle Scrooge story, and A Christmas for Shacktown, along with an assortment of Donald's other adventures. These twin volumes feature page after page of intrepid guests, clever humor, and heartwarming themes, published by Fantagraphics, of course, written and drawn by Carl Barks. 480 pages, full color hardcover, and a slipcase was $49.99, but you save 30% on in-stock trades for $34.99. So this is a great one. Do you have this one, Sean?
I don't know. But I know Carl Barks is just a phenomenal.
I know you've read that Christmas on Bear Mountain. I don't know about the other ones, but
I did read that one, yeah.
They reprinted that one in that, what, the Infinity Dime? Wasn't that where it was? They reprinted that one recently. All right, so thanks to InStock Trades again. Let's move on and discuss the issue we want to talk about today. So today's comic, of course, is indeed A Christmas Treat. It's DC Special Series number 21, The Superstar Holiday Special. This was published in December of 1979 with a cover date of April 1980, a $1 cover price. It had 64 pages, edited by Len Wein. So Sean, did you have this one as a kid?
At the time it came out, 1980, I did not have this particular issue. The first Christmas comic I ever got was the second DC Treasury. And even that was like years after it came out. We'll talk about how I read the Legion story the first time when we get to that. I don't know what the first Christmas comic I had at Christmas time. Mm-hmm. It seems like I got a lot of the Christmas books years after they were published.
I know you told this on air, but I know that you used to get some comics at Christmas, so that makes them extra special for you. Sort of like your Mountain comics, except they're Christmas stocking comics.
So actually, as Paul was talking, I did remember, and maybe I told this story on air. I did have a Rudolph Treasury when it came out, but I was in sixth grade, and like I was quote unquote too old to read a Rudolph Treasury. And in my sixth grade mind, I thought, well, if I tell people that I got this free at the bank, it'll be okay that I have this and I'm reading it. I have no idea where that idea formed. Now, I will say, I don't remember the kids making fun of me for reading it. So thumbs up, Spring Grove Intermediate, for not making fun of me for reading a Rudolph comic in sixth grade. But I don't know why getting it for free at a bank would have made it okay. But in my mind, it did. That treasury I did have concurrent with the holiday.
Nice. Any other traditions about Christmas comics you want to share with the listeners? I'm going to ask all the people on the show this question.
Definitely had, and I've talked about this before, stocking comics. Christmas morning, we had like a literal fireplace in our basement. So we would stand by the fireplace and we had stockings. And these stockings were like chock full of stuff. Little toys, stuff. Okay, so there was always like an orange at the bottom of the... I just thought that was the dumbest thing. Like literally we had a box of oranges in the garage. Mom just took an orange and put it at the bottom of the stocking. I just thought it was the dumbest thing. So there was always an orange, but you really hoped that there were batteries, because if there were batteries at the bottom of your stocking, that means you got your microvision or like the thing that needed batteries for
so
your
wait,
toys.
You opened your stockings before your presents?
Yes.
We did our presents first and stockings second. Interesting.
The stockings were the very first thing. So we had Christmas in our basement. We would start off at the top of the steps. Every 10 minutes, we would kind of like slide down another step because it took mom forever to make her tea and dad to get ready for whatever. So then once we were allowed over on the side that had Christmas, then we would go right to the fireplace and we would get our picture taken holding our stocking. But at the very top of the stocking was always maybe like three or four comics that were half rolled to fit in the stocking, but I didn't mind. And it's funny, I'll need to go through Mike's. I definitely remember it's either Superman or Action with Superman and Solomon Grundy on the tram. He's tugging on Superman's
cover.
Tape. That definitely was in my stocking for stocking comics.
Excellent. I had not so much comics in my stockings, but I got things like, I know I got the Batman Encyclopedia for Christmas and like that over the years. That's a great story.
There's no doubt that I got some like superhero stuff.
Yeah.
And I guess if I went through, I probably could remember specifically what I got. But but definitely stocking comics I remember.
Yeah. One year when I think I was in college, might have been late high school, my sister, who's 8 years younger than me, she decorated a couple comic boxes for me. One with the has the
Ooh.
Batman logo, and then another one with the Superman, and then she drew a Spider-Man that was in the same pose because she took an issue of Peter Parker, the Spectacular Spider-Man, where it's sort of like Spider-Man's running, and she drew that on the top of a box lid. I still have it, and so I'm looking at
That's
it right over there. Maybe
cool.
I'll add a picture of one or more of those things to
gotta say, put it in the gallery.
Put in the gallery so you guys can all see my sister's artwork, who's probably about 10 or 12 at the time. All right, let's move on to Wayne Special Investments. So this comic is a little more valuable and popular than some of the other specials we've covered. It looks like you can get a lower grade copy online for under 10 bucks. But if you want a higher grade, a nice one, you probably need to spend closer to 20. But never fear, listeners. Just like last month's Dinosaur Special, this one is also actually on DC Universe Infinite. So go read it right now. Again, we'll wait and then come back. But what else was on sale December 1979? Sean, you'll never guess, but we lucked out. This was not a month that we have previously talked about on Batman Family Reunion. Batman Family, of course, had been canceled by now and migrated to Detective, but there was no issue of Detective this month. This is one of the times it was bi-monthly, so we've never spoken about these slate of issues. Thanks, of course, to our favorite website, Mike's Amazing World of Comics. I'll start out with just a couple, pointing out the fantastic Batman number 321, which is entitled Dreadful Birthday, Dear Joker, by Len Wein and Walt Simonson, with the iconic cover by Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, praise be his name, with Batman, Robin, and Alfred, and Commissioner Gordon, all tied to giant burning candles and the Joker inviting us to the party. I mean, that's just a great comic book all around. There's also a weird one that I had never seen before. It's called the Superboy Spectacular number 1. Mike's calls it the first direct sales only DC comic, which I always thought was that Madame Xanadu comic, right? But apparently this was distributed also through school systems. I'd never seen this comic before. It's a 64-page dollar comic, but strangely does not have the dollar comic trade dress. It has Superboy and Crypto on the cover. It's weird. Listeners, if anybody has this issue or has seen it or whatever, let me know in the comments and where you saw it or where you got it, because I'm curious about it. And then for Marvel, we had a couple cool oversized comics, including a Marvel Treasury number 25, which is Spider-Man and the Hulk at the Winter Olympics, which was covered by Rob and Tom Paneris on Treasury Cast number 66 from 2022, and Marvel Super Special number 15, the magazine-sized adaption of Star Trek The Motion Picture. So, Sean, I know you are itching to talk about some more of these comics. I think I can make a small, tiny guess at least some of the ones you picked.
Well, specialers. Oh, what are your listeners called? I'm calling them specialers. Okay, specialers, start putting on the Yule log, because by the time I'm done, you'll have to put a second Yule log on, because this is a bumper crop. Adventure Comics number 469, and that's part of the Plastic Man Starman run, and I love those issues. There was a Battle of the Planets from Gold Key. And as always, I have no doubt that the cover is 10,000% better than like the artwork. But I'd be interested in seeing what that is. Mm-hmm. The next one I am holding up in my hands, and that is the Best of DC Digest, Blue Ribbon Digest number 4, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. And this is fantastic because there is a brand new Rudolph story in here.
That's what I was going to ask you. Does that have a new one in addition to some of the...
It does. And probably it's like leftover material. I am legally obligated by Batman Family Reunion standards to bring up DC Comics Presents number 19, which is Superman and Batgirl. The next one I'm going to talk about, I am holding in my hands. It is DC Special Blue Ribbon Digest number 1.
Number 1.
With the Legion of Superheroes. It's all coming together. The next one I'm going to talk about is Marvel Fun and Games number 7. I love Marvel Fun and Games. And then to find out, I think like what, 99.9% of that book was done by one person, if not 100%. That flabbergasts me.
What was that? That was the article on, was it back issue that we saw that? I didn't know that either. That was fascinating.
Yeah, the New Adventures of Superboy number 3. I got a lot of those titles when they came out. I'm working on completing that collection. I think I'm going to have 11 more to get. So I'll do a read through of that once I get all of those. The Legend Lives On. I am talking about Spider-Woman number 24 so that I get a color collection of Spider-Woman.
You want two
stories.
Epic collections is what you want. You can get the whole run in two epic collections. I do not understand why that does not exist.
Yes. Rob Kelly's coming up in a little bit, and his excellent For All Mankind podcast talked about Super Friends number 30, and that issue has Gorilla Grodd, and that is fantastic. I'm going to skip a comic book we're going to talk about a little bit later. And there was, of course, What If number 19. I only had maybe two or three of the What Ifs when they came out, but I since went back and got all four of the, because What If has been reprinted like 18 different times, but it's the covers that are basically white with the white spines, and it's four volumes. And of course, it would not be Mike's Amazing Comics without an official Richie Rich comic count. In the year of our Lord, December 1979, there were 10 Richie Rich comic books on the stand, including a digest.
All
Yay!
right. That's fantastic. Yeah, it was a bumper crop. Usually, a lot of the specials and really good stuff they put out in the summertime when I guess they figured the kids had more money, but I guess the holiday times was a good time too. But
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I have no doubt that's why. I think like around November, December, and summer, there were 138 Richie Rich titles
yeah.
on the stands.
Let's go and start talking about the comic. Sean, you want to tell us about the cover?
This is a beautiful cover, of course, because of PBGA, I'm sorry, PBGL.
PBA,
Yeah, I know. All the letters of the alphabet. The first thing you notice is the dollar banner, the two circles with the bar across, and it's five all-new stories: Batman, House of Mystery, Jonah Hex, Sergeant Rock, Superboy, and the Legion. Underneath is Superstar in red modern font, and then Holiday Special in Christmas lettering. And right between Holiday and Special, there is a white, bright, shining star. And that star is leading the characters towards the center point of the upper center point of the cover. You see Superboy, and you see his chest and his front and his face, but you see him flying towards the star. You see the side of Lightning Lad, Dream Girl, Wildfire, Phantom Girl. You get to see Jonah Hex on a horse, and the horse is rearing up, and
I love that. Yeah,
that looks fantastic. You see one of the witches flying over his shoulder. Sergeant Rock is looking up. It almost looks like he's saluting, but he's holding his hat to look at the star. Batman has his hand forward to beckon you to come with him to go to the star. And the best thing is on like kind of like the lower left is Cain and Abel on a
yeah,
camel.
I love
With
that.
a whole bunch of stuff on the back. And they're kind of pointed the wrong way, but that's so that you can see the camel's head and not the other end of the camel. And then at the very bottom is some text that says, "Join the world's greatest heroes in quest of a dream."
Yeah, I mean, this is just a fantastic cover. And there's a very strong theme that goes through this comic book. It's front and center right on the cover of the Star of Bethlehem. Batman is smiling. Superboy looks great. Garcia Lopez draws Superboy not like a 12-year-old, but not like a 30-year-old man. He draws him like an 18-year-old kid. He looks great. He's happy. He's got his buddies there. They're all flying towards the star. I love the witch in the corner, one of the witching hour witches. Jonah Hex on the horse. He's doffed his cap as they're rearing towards it. I mean, it's just a fantastic cover with a black background. All the stars in the sky really pop. It's really a fantastic image. How could you not? You see this on the stand. It's December 1979. How can you not plunk down your dollar for this comic book? Many of our specials do include a table of contents, but we don't really get a table of contents, at least not a traditional one. Sean, you want to explain what we do get?
Yes, this is basically two panels, and then at the second panel, there's an arrow inset. The Midnight Sky is an infinite tapestry woven with pinpoint patterns of stars that shine in eternal profusion. But there is one star that shines more brightly than the rest. On a wintry night almost 2,000 years ago, three wise and weary kings of ancient lands followed that brightly shining star to a sheltered stable in the village of Bethlehem, and the world would never again be the same. On that selfsame night, in centuries since, the star has shone again over the war-torn Italy, over the snow-swept Colorados, over bustling Gotham City, over a ramshackle Kentucky mansion, and over a world that is yet to be. The star has made its presence felt. Come along now with the world's greatest heroes to follow that star, and your world, too, may never again be the same.
Nicely
I
done.
do love that, but I do have to point out when they say follow the world's greatest heroes to the star, you know that's wrong because Dead Man's not here, Man Bat isn't here. So I guess other than that, I think this splash page is really nice. It has, right at the top, it has the star. The star is beaming down on the stable. Jose Luis Garcia Lopez loves camel drawing.
Actually, I don't think this is Garcia Lopez.
I guess we'll keep this in, even though I was wrong.
No, I'll take it out.
No, keep it in.
Actually, Sean, Mike's doesn't tell us, but the Grand Comics Database, comics.org, tells us that this script on this page was written by Len Wein, and the art was Jerry Talawak. He's the guy who's done a lot of mystery titles over the years.
Thank you for correcting me and preventing me from get a lump of coal instead of comics in my stocking. Thank you.
This page is really neat, and again, it's a very strong theme. All the stories have to do with the star, which is really a nice package. Of course, I will post the cover, this splash page, and several other pages on the gallery page for DC Special Cast at fireandwaterpodcast.com. So, Sean, I know you need your beauty rest. So do you want to hang out in the blue room over the DC Special studio until your story is ready? There's still a few Christmas decorations to put up. I could use your help.
I'm not putting up decorations. I'm practicing my caroling. It'll nearly be like a picture print by Currier and Ives. A lot of people don't know who Currier and... Maybe people from our generation know who Currier and Ives are, but people who are 20 and 30 probably don't know who Currier
probably not. I bet my kids don't.
While you guys talk about the stories, I'm going to go work on improving the public knowledge about Currier and Ives.
Okay, sounds good. All right, I'm going to step out of the DC Special Studio and head right next door to the Fantastic Lounge. That's right, my guest for the first story is none other than Brett Young. Hey, Brett, welcome back to DC Special Cast.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here, especially this time of year. And I'm glad you came over here to the Fantastic Lounge. We're starting to decorate now.
I know, it looks good. They got the lights up and everything.
Yeah, it's all about the lights. Knowing me, we'll take them down sometime in April, just in time for Easter. But yeah, I'm a big fan of the holiday, so we'll have lots of lights up here and some good eggnog and holiday cheer.
Awesome. So, Brett, this comic was a little early for you, but Did you have any special comics around Christmas time or any memories you have that you want to share?
Yeah, I did. I'm not a particularly religious guy, but I am a big fan of the Christmas holiday season. And I love a lot of aspects of the season, spending time with the family, Christmas parties, lots of food, wine, and cocktails. There's a football game on every day, at least one, all that stuff. So yeah, there were certain comics that I always enjoyed. So there's Amazing Spider-Man 314, which Ooh. Is by David Michelinie and Todd McFarlane. One where like Spidey and MJ help out a shopkeeper during Christmas. It was always one of those ones I just always read at Christmas time.
I think I know the one you're talking about. That's good. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a pretty famous issue. So DC Comics presents 67, which is Superman and Santa Claus.
A classic.
Which I got autographed by JLGL.
Yeah.
So from my collection, I was happy
I love
about
it.
That. The Legion story that you're covering with Sean.
And that's been reprinted a lot of places.
Yes. I had it in a digest, I'm pretty sure. I think it was reprinted in one of the digests. So, and two more. One, Lobo's paramilitary Christmas special. I don't know if you remember that one.
I remember that.
That came out right when I was in college or right before I started. I think maybe I was a senior or junior in high school or something like that.
Did you buy all the Lobo comics?
I wasn't a huge Lobo fan. I found that one very compelling because I was just like, what? And it, basically the premise is the Easter Bunny hires Lobo to kill Santa Claus.
That's right. I remember. I'm ashamed to say I had most of the Lobo comics. At some point, it got too much for me. I stopped buying them. But I had a lot of the ones at the beginning and had that one. They're all long gone. I hadn't thought about that comic in a long time.
Yeah.
It's a funny one.
Yeah, I used to read that every year. There was a three, and I actually talked about this very briefly in one of my more recent episodes of Fantastic Four. I was talking with Ward Hill Terry about this. Steve Rude and Dave Gibbons wrote it. It's a World's Finest prestige format. It's a three-issue miniseries.
Yeah.
It takes place around Christmas time. And there's a great moment in the second one where Superman, after they're kind of done, Batman's about to drive off in the snowy road. And Superman says, oh, I almost forgot, and pulls out a present for him, which kind of throws him off. And he opens it. It's a videotape of Zorro. And he's sort of stunned at first because he's just like, oh, I thought it'd be something you'd be into, having no idea what the meaning of it was. It was just a really touching moment between the two of them. So one other thing I used to do, and I talked to Ryan Daly about this one time, is every year when my parents would put out the nativity scene, I'd put all my G.I. Joe and Cobras around it as if the baby Jesus was the MacGuffin, and there was a big battle, and I'd stage these big battles around the nativity scene. So I used to read a lot of these. There's one that came out last year or the year before, which was about Batman and Santa Claus. And it had all the other Justice League. And it was pretty good. It's pretty good. It was like a 4 or 6 issue miniseries. I forget what it was. So that was really good. I enjoyed
They're doing
that.
A sequel, I think, this year.
Yeah. Oh, and then every year for like the last probably almost 10 years now, I write and draw a book for my kids every year at Christmas time. And it's kind of taken on a life of its own at this point. First couple of times, it was just something I hand painted and it was just a few pages. And now I basically am doing them like little mini graphic novels for them. And it's almost, awesome. I'm almost taking on too much at this point. Like last year, it killed me to get it done before Christmas Eve. But it's a lot of fun. It's a labor of love. You know, I do it every year. And you'll
have it forever. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. But we are here to talk about a certain story and one that Brett picked out because we know how much he likes his Western characters from the two drafts that we've had. We're here to talk about Jonah Hex. And in our first story called The Fawn and the Star, it's a 10-pager written by Michael Fleischer and penciled by Dick Ayers and inked by Romeo Tangle. And as far as I can tell, has never been reprinted. So, Brett, do you want to run through the synopsis? I did crib quite a bit from Mike's Amazing World for this.
Yeah, absolutely. So I added a little to the synopsis or just changed it around a little bit. Nothing dirty. It's Christmas time. Come on. It's Christmas Eve as our favorite bounty hunter, Jonah Hex, is out in the snow-covered woods tracking a pair of wanted outlaws called the Tull Brothers. Even during the holiday season, Hex is joined by his two companions, Death and the acrid smell of gun smoke. During his hunt, Hex comes upon a father and a daughter who are arguing about an injured fawn. The father is ready to shoot the fawn for the family's Christmas dinner, but the young daughter is fiercely trying to stop him and protect the fawn. Observing the scene, Hex remembers a pet raccoon he had from his childhood that his own father killed and fed to his son for dinner. Maybe it's the season of giving, or maybe it's the memory of the raccoon he ate. But Hex strikes a deal with his father. If Hex can find them another suitable dinner, the fawn can live. As night approaches, Hex realizes game is scarce, and so is daylight. Hex sees a bright star and follows it out of desperation. The star leads him to a cave where the Tull brothers have holed up. The Tull brothers shoot him twice, but Hex is just stunned and shrugs it off. Whipping out his pistol, Hex fills one of the brothers full of lead. Jonah then blows up the other brother with a stick of dynamite. Fortunately, the Tull's backpack was not damaged, and our hero brings the pack full of provisions back to the families so the fawn can survive. The family is grateful, although the father admits he probably wouldn't have been able to shoot the fawn after seeing his daughter react like that anyway. Jonah wonders if the lucky star brought him to the cave and the bag of victuals, but decides he just got lucky and heads off into the woods with the dead Tulls in tow. Merry Christmas, everyone.
Merry Christmas. Much better than what I wrote. Yeah, that was great. So what'd you think of the story overall?
Oh, it's great. The great thing about most Jonah Hex stories is they're one and dones and they're direct and to the point. You know, it's odd. This one was written by Michael Fleischer. Almost everything I read of Jonah Hex is written by Jimmy Palmiotti in the last however many years.
But Fleischer was the guy who wrote Hex regular series for many years.
The sci-fi one?
I think he wrote that too, but he wrote the original. Palmiotti came in late 90s, early 2000s.
Okay, that's most of what I've read. I've read sort of up from there. It's a quick story. The beauty of it is that it takes the place of a few hours, more or less. He finds his mission, like a lot of Westerns. He's wandering, finds a mission, completes the mission, and heads off into the sunset or the woods in this case. You know, it's a little odd that this, you know, religious symbol of the star is basically responsible for him murdering two guys. But, it's a good, concise story.
There is a theme to this issue, as we're going to find out, listeners. I like the art, too. I mean, the art's pretty good. I thought Dick Ayers, he did some good work on the Wonder Woman special that I talked about with Sean.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I always like Romeo Tangle, who's done a lot of work in this particular issue. I thought the horse looks great. I do like the scarf over the cowboy hat look.
Yes, that was a little odd.
But it's red. Maybe that's his decoration.
Maybe. Yeah, that's true. That could be him, Hex being Christmassy. It almost looks like one of those old things when he had the toothache, you know, and he'd wrap the thing around it. Yeah, I was going to say, Ayers knows how to draw a horse, which is paramount. If you're going to do a Jonah Hex story, you got to be able to draw a horse. And he does a good job. And I like the splash page because the horse is kind of lifting the one leg up because it's traversing through deeper snow. So it's not just like wandering along a clear path and everything. It's just sort of a nice touch that the horse kind of has the one leg up. It's got to work a little harder to get through the snow, which is pretty cool.
And then we come to the scene where it comes upon the father and the daughter, and the daughter's like, no, daddy, please don't shoot him. Shoot him again. I guess he shot him once already and the fawn is injured.
Did he already shoot it once, or was the fawn, is that why he was going to shoot the fawn, because it was injured?
At the top left here, page two, it says, no, you can't shoot him again. You can't.
Oh, you're right.
I think it was her pet. They were hungry. You know, yeah. Like, this is a perfectly good meal for the family. I mean, he's trying to take care of his family, but they're out in the middle of nowhere, I suppose. Before you read the flashback, it's a little out of character for Jonah Hex to care about this.
Yeah. And to help the fawn, like, he gets down off the horse and he's helping the girl mend the fawn's leg, which, again, you're right. Normally he'd whip out his pistol and shoot it himself or something like that and be like, here you go.
He does say at the bottom of three, good Lord, Jonah Hex, what in tarnation did you go and do that for?
Yeah.
I'll allow it in the spirit of Christmas and him flashing back to his raccoon. But I found the raccoon sequence amazing. I don't know. Yes. What else to say?
Well, as much kindness as we've given Dick Ayers, I will say this. Young Jonah Hex ages forwards and backwards in these drawings about seven different times. There are times when he looks like he's about maybe six, and there are times when he looks like he's about 25.
On the page four, the six-year-old is petting the raccoon or getting the raccoon out of the trap. And then the third panel, he looks like he's a teenager.
I know. I know, he looks much older. Then he gets younger again. And by the time his dad whacks him, he gets older again. Yeah.
I do like the hat. Did they have that kind of hat in like Jonah Hex was in the Civil War, right? So these are taking place in like the 1880s. In 1866. So this has to be like in the 1840s or 50s, right? That this sequence is happening. So did they have that little hat?
Did they have those winter hats with the flaps? Yeah, I don't think so. Yeah.
They seem to have a pretty nice house. I always got the feeling Jonah Hex grew up really poor.
If I'm remembering his origin correctly, so his, you know, he had parents, obviously. His dad was sort of this abusive alcoholic, but I don't think they were wanting. He was kind of one of those terrible fathers who probably had a rough upbringing himself and decided to take it out on everybody else. Like, even the way he's dressed, he's in pretty nice clothing.
Yeah, he looks a little dandy.
Yeah, I think they do fine financially, but I think he sort of, even though they're doing okay financially, I feel like he makes his wife and child suffer a bit just because he's a jerk.
At the bottom of four, he's clearly drinking. He does the comic book. But he's got a bottle in his hand.
Yeah, and his father eventually sells him to an Indian tribe later on after the mother runs away. She runs off with like a traveling salesman or something like that, something weird like that. So he's kind of raised by this tribe for a while, and then he's kicked out. And then after the Civil War, he gives himself up because he was in the South and became disillusioned because of slavery. Gives himself up, goes back to the tribe, and has a duel with the chief's son, who he kills, and then as punishment, that's how he gets his face disfigured. They use a heated axe and they put it on his face. That's an aside.
But the best scene in the story, why don't you tell our listeners what happens at dinner?
So at one point, young Jonah asks his dad, "Hey, is it okay if I, you know, keep the raccoon in the woodshed?" And he's like, "Yeah, that's fine. So they're having dinner later, and he wants to hurry up with his meal because he wants to go out and check on his raccoon and everything.
Well, he's named Roy for some reason.
Roy, yes. And then the mom's like, "Who's Roy?" And he says, "The raccoon." And he's like, "Uh-oh." And that's when the dad lets him know that basically he's eating Roy right now for dinner. And young Jonah gets very upset. And then, of course, the dad's an abusive creep, so he whacks him, and you know, it's a terrible scene. He basically, you know, he ate his pet.
So I can allow that the scene with the fawn and the girl stirred something not usually stirred in
certainly
the next.
Yeah.
All right.
No, they earned it with that. He's not just like, well, fine, I'll be a good guy because of the season. Yeah, there's a reason behind this. Yeah, absolutely. And he immediately, like you said, he immediately regrets it, you know, because it's starting to get dark. He can't see anything. It's snowy, you know, so there's not game around for him to hunt down to begin with, let alone when it's dark, too.
And it's dark, but then it gets light.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the star. So he follows the star for a bit and he comes upon a cave. But who's in that cave, Brett?
The Tull brothers are in that cave and they're ready, and they see Jonah before he sees them. The one brother hits him twice with his rifle, shoots him twice with the rifle. Apparently Jonah just falls down and he's okay though. So I guess he just winged him.
I know. I was dying when I was preparing, and I remember how much you enjoyed the people in Batman Family getting shot and then just shaking it off.
Yes.
Here's Jonah doing the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. I think I did an episode of the Batman Family Reunion with you where some kid fell off a radio tower or something like that. And Batman's like, oh, see, he's just stunned. He'll be fine. It's like, what does that mean? Does he have a concussion? Is he have broken ribs? What does stunned mean? Yeah, so I guess Jonah was just stunned for a moment. And then he pulls out the pistol and laying on his back, shoots the one brother dead. And then still lying down, pulls out some dynamite, lights. I don't know where he lit it from, but he just pulls out lit dynamite and throws a perfect pass. Like he's like he's an NFL quarterback straight into the cave.
Yeah, I was wondering where he came up with the dynamite too, but what are you going to do? But he has dynamite with him.
That's Jonah Hex. He's going to have some dynamite.
And then he goes into the cave, and while the guys are both dead, the backpack with their food is perfectly fine.
Perfect. It's really good.
Christmas dinner.
I'll give Dick Ayers that. He made sure the vantage point you get when you see the backpack is actually from, like, if you were standing behind the backpack in the cave. You see Jonah entering the cave. So the backpack was kind of deep in the cave a bit. So maybe that's what saved it a bit. Maybe it was kind of behind a rock. But that's quite an explosion. It basically just, it's like an inferno out of the cave.
But the bodies are still recognizable.
Bodies are fine. Yep. Still clothed.
Tosses them over to our horse. And takes him in like a good bounty hunter. But he stops off at the family's house and hands over the backpack. The dad complains. He's like, "What? There's nothing in here but trail provisions, hard tack, and beef jerky."
Yeah, yeah.
And Hex is like, "Hey, beggars can't be choosers."
Yeah, exactly. He said, "I didn't say I was going to bring you a 5-course meal. Come on, you get what you get." Now, did you know what hard tack was?
I've heard of it, but I didn't know what exactly. I don't know exactly what I know. Beef jerky is, but I assumed it was something like that. What is it?
Yeah, no, it's bread. Like it's a heavy bread that I guess can stay, you know, it doesn't get stale as easily. So
starts out stale, maybe.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's just like this heavy bread that they eat. So I had to look it up. I didn't know what it was. So I saw
it. I failed my constituents by not looking that up. Yeah.
We don't know what the other trail provisions were. I assume water.
It's a whole backpack. Whatever. It's enough for dinner for a family.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But here's the thing. So if they're that desperate for food, how long is this fawn going to last? You know, because if they're eating beef jerky for Christmas Eve.
Well, maybe the snow will melt and they can make it down to the village and buy provisions or something. I don't know.
Maybe. Yeah, I don't know. I don't think we're long. I say that fawn's got maybe a week in it.
And then I did like how the dad said, "I don't know that I could have shot him anyway."
Yeah, no, that was nice. And maybe that's another reason Jonah saw the heart in the father, the kindness in the father that he never got in his. Yeah. So maybe he saw some of that too.
And then he rides off into the star rise, not the sunset, but the star rise. He rides off.
Absolutely. With the Toll Brothers' dead bodies over the
dragon behind him. Happy Christmas.
Yes. The Christmas star.
Merry Christmas
star.
To the Toll Brothers.
Yep. Not a good Christmas for the Toll Brothers.
Well, we've been making a little fun of the story, but I actually quite enjoyed the story. I thought it was a pretty good story. You know, if you don't think too hard about the position of Jonah Hex in the world and how that relates to Christmas, it's a pretty good story. And it's in the flavor of Jonah Hex stories, which is great.
Absolutely.
And it's clearly a holiday story. So, you know, good on them.
No, absolutely. It is right in line with your typical Jonah Hex story. There's nothing unusual or anything. He always has these conflicts of conscience and often will do the right thing in the end. This time it didn't take him as long to do it. Great little Jonah Hex story. Anytime you can mix in Christmas and a Western's always fun too.
Well, that was great. So thank you, Brett. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Happy holidays.
Got to head on down the dusty trail.
Got to head to Kentucky now. I'm sure I'll see you soon, but happy holidays. Merry Christmas.
Yeah. The same to you and to everyone out there in DC Special Cast Lounge from all of us here at the Fantastic Lounge. Absolutely. Happy holidays.
All right. I've left the Fantastic Lounge and I'm heading down from DC to Kentucky to check out the House of Frankenstein. Or I guess since Halloween is over, is it just the House of Franklin? Right? Hey, Chris, welcome back to DC Special Cast.
Hey, Paul, how's it going? Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. So, Chris, I've been asking everybody what kind of special Christmas memories they have related to comic books, either Christmas stories or stocking comics like Sean has or something like that. Wondered if you had any stories you want to tell us about.
Sure. Well, one's pretty pivotal, I think, for this network, for my connection to it. Christmas of 1984, I was 10. And I found a new comic I had never seen before rolled up in my stocking. It was Who's Who number one.
Oh,
Yeah, I had seen the Do You Know Me ads in the comics with Abbot Nazar, Wrath and Ghast and Atomic Knight and those characters, but I didn't know what the cover would look like. So, I instantly knew, ooh, George Perez, ooh, Aquaman, But I guess Santa or my mom assisting him saw Aquaman and thought, he likes Aquaman and bought it. Would I be on this podcast right now without that decision? Maybe not. I don't
That's awesome. That's awesome. That's a great cover too. So what more can you ask, right?
Right. And also, in addition, I was always a big fan of all the digest Christmas with the superheroes. I missed the Treasuries. I was a little too young for that, although I got them later. But I had the digest that, reprinted some of the Christmas stories. And then I had the two DC Christmas with the superhero specials. Another thing I do remember getting specifically for Christmas in 1988, ahead of the 50th anniversary, I got the Greatest Batman Stories Ever Told hardcover for Christmas.
Nice,
And
nice.
I remember reading most of it Christmas Day by the light of our Christmas tree. So,
Oh, that's a great book. And I know I've mentioned this on other times, but my copy of that, also gotten when it came out, is one of my most, if not my very most prized possession, because I've got in there signatures from like 20 or 30 creators, from Julie Schwartz to Neil Adams to Carmine Infantino. And I even got Jerry Robinson when I met him once. So
wow,
yeah,
that's
so
awesome.
that's my prized possession. So that's a fantastic book. I read that one multiple times. I ended up getting the paperback version, so I stopped reading the hardcover and just I could reread the paperback version.
Right. I got the paperback about 15 years or so ago. I don't know what the deal was because I'm pretty sure that's a pretty pricey volume, but this one booth at a comic show had it for like 20, 25 bucks. And I bought another copy of it because mine's dog-eared to death. I mean, the Dave Dorman dust jacket cover is completely shredded. I mean, I literally read it to death. That's awesome. You've got basically it's an autograph book of Batman creators. That's awesome.
The one that I really wish I could have gotten, of course, is Jim Aparo. I never had the fortune to meet him. I do also know one of your favorite Christmas stories, right? Robin's Merry Very Christmas.
Right, yeah. We talked about that on Batman Family
A
Reunion.
long
Yeah.
time ago, a
Long
long
time
time ago.
ago. Yeah. Where Robin has the line about, I could give you some line about having bat thermal underwear, but no, I'm freezing.
No, that's a great one. Well, thanks for sharing that. And listeners, Chris and I have an absolute classic to discuss. It's Batman, of course, in Wanted, Santa Claus, Dead or Alive. It is a 10-pager written by Denny O'Neil, penciled by Frank Miller in his first ever published Batman art, inked by Steve Mitchell. Has been reprinted many times in the aforementioned Christmas with the Superheroes from 88 that Chris mentioned, the complete Frank Miller Batman hardcover from 1990, a DC Universe Christmas trade paperback, which is another great trade paperback to have, Batman, The Greatest Stories Ever Told, Volume 1 trade paperback, and a celebration of 75 years from 2014. So it's preprinted all over the place. Can read this on DC Universe Infinite, like the rest of these stories. Chris, would you like to give us the synopsis and kick us off?
Yes. Crime knows no holiday in Gotham, and so the Dark Knight can't rest on Christmas Eve. We open our story as Batman swings by a large nativity display and he notices the star has been stolen, but he doesn't have time to investigate. He is searching for answers about a ship docked in Gotham Harbor. So Batman crashes a Christmas party in a hideout owned by gang boss Matty Lasco. After embarrassing Matty and his thugs, Matty confesses to Batman that he has scheduled the boat to wait in the harbor for his old cellmate, Boomer Katz. Batman does his rubber mask thing and heads to a soup kitchen for some undercover investigation. After learning there that Boomer had taken a job as a Santa Claus at Lee's department store, Batman realizes Boomer has taken that job to help somebody knock over the store. But Boomer has succumbed to the Christmas spirit, especially after his interaction with the kids and receiving the accolades of the store manager on his role as Santa. Thus, he can't bring himself to disable the store's alarm system and meets up with gangster Fats Morgan to tell him he is out of the crime business. But Fats forces Katz to get them admitted at gunpoint, and when Boomer runs for it, shoots him in the arm. Batman is drawn by the gunfire and captures Morgan and most of his men in the store, using some of the Christmas decorations to stand in as batarangs. But where's Boomer? Unknown to Batman and the two policemen who arrive, Boomer is being held prisoner by one of Morgan's men under the nativity display. But just as they are about to give up the search, a brilliant star's light pours through the hole where a stolen star of Bethlehem had been and clearly outlines Boomer and his captor. Batman takes out the crook, By the time he and Boomer can look up again, the brilliant star is gone. The end.
Nice. So what'd you think overall of this story, Chris?
Oh, like you said, I mean, it's a classic. Although I will say, Denny really liked his Christmas miracle endings. He wrote several Batman Christmas stories, Silent Night, Deadly Night from Batman 239 in 1971. A horse-drawn sled magically appears to help Batman take a dying old man to a hospital. And then in Merry Christmas from Batman number 247 from 1972, the Christmas star appears and blinds a gunman so Batman can knock him out and save a family and a grumpy old amateur astronomer who informs him that there shouldn't have been a star there. So he kind of cribbed that ending here, but it's his own ending, so it's okay.
As all the other guests have shown, this comic in general has a very strong theme going throughout the comic, right?
It's, yes.
The star has got a really prominent role and plays a part in the resolution in pretty much all of the stories. So I think that's a cool thing.
Yeah, it's a nice through line. It really is. And I mean, it's even on the cover, you know, and they're all gathering around, you know, toward the star. So yeah, it's well done. It's actually, I think the device probably works a little better here than it does in the previous story because he sets it up that the nativity star has been stolen.
Right. So. Let's walk through it a little bit. And we can talk about the art as we go through. So I have some comments about, you know, Frank Miller doesn't look like Frank Miller did 10 years later.
No.
But you see some flashes of it that I do want to point out as we walk through. On page one, we get the image. You can see right where the star has been stolen. And I think the cape is a little more Adams or Aparo-like than reminding me of Frank Miller, but still very effective, I think. And the way that the nativity scene is all sort of lit up from the bottom, I just think it's a really great splash page to start off the story.
Oh, yeah, I agree. It's really well done. I really do like the moody lighting. And you're right. This is a very Adams-esque Batman. It's not the big hulking Batman of it looks a little more like the way he drew him in like the first issue and a half of the Dark Knight series because his style morphs over that. But yeah, it's definitely more of it keeping with the model. And I do like his cape. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty realistic cape. It's not ridiculously long or it's shaped to his body. It looks good.
And then we get the scene on pages 2 and 3 where Batman crashes the nightclub. And if you look at some of the girls in the Santa outfits, they look a lot more, especially their eyes look a lot more Frank Miller to me.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing I thought looked definitely like him. I saw a little bit more like Marshall Rogers influence here, like at the bottom of page 2, you know, where he's got his cape all splayed out like that. To me, looks a little Marshall Rogers-ish, and the way he cracks the two guys at the top of page 3, I think, to me, reminded me a little more of Marshall Rogers. He's not as svelte as Marshall Rogers as Batman, of course, but he just reminded me a little bit of it there.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. He's got that capage, which we're talking about right now and over on Nightcast. That's a good call. Maddie Lasco and the ladies, they could maybe be from Sin City. You know, there's a little Sin City there, you know. Yeah. It's kind of got a seedy, sleazy feel to it.
Yeah. It's supposed to, right?
Right.
My favorite part in this sequence, though, is when Maddie tries to intimidate Batman and rolls up his sleeves and gives him a big roundhouse into his abs, and he hurts his own hand. Batman's like, dude, I didn't even feel that.
That's great. Yeah, I love it. And Maddie's got huge arms, too, so you think it would actually hurt. I wonder, does Denny trying to say something about Marty Pasco, Maddie Lasco, Marty Pasco?
I don't know.
Just the first thing I read it, when I first read it, I'm like, wait, did he say Marty Pasco?
So Batman gets the name of Boomer from Maddie. And heads to one of his haunts. And it wouldn't be a Bronze Age Batman story if he didn't have a disguise. And so he's disguised. He goes into this food kitchen and is asking some of the other folks there about, you know, what's happened to Boomer. And he finds out and love that he hands the, you know, person running the shelter $1,000 on his way out.
It's just
fantastic.
That's great. That's a nice little bit of reminder of Batman put his money where his mouth is, you know?
And we think we know where it's gone at this time, right? That Boomer is bad and Batman's got to take him down. Then we get Boomer and he's got a tear in his eye on the next page. And I just really love that he had second thoughts.
Right. When I was at first rereading this, I thought, okay, they completely coerced him into it. My memory was that they literally strong-armed him into it because he had been a criminal. But it's like, no, he was kind of going along with it because he had the boat ready because of his time with the kids and playing Santa Claus. The Christmas spirit got to him, you know?
Yeah,
So
I think
I
that's
like
great.
that.
The owner of the store is like, "You're the best Santa we've ever had, Boomer," which is just fantastic. We get the scene where the bad guys say, "Hey, you're not backing out now." And they force him to go back to the store in the back door and they buzz him in. And the guy's like, "Forget something, Boomer." And they force their way in and they shoot Boomer.
I mean, I had to look at it again because there's three blams, but apparently they only hit him once in the shoulder, like in the arm, like you said. But I think the first time I read this in the Christmas with the superheroes, I thought they killed him right there. I'm like, wow, this story's dark, you know? I mean, because it looks like they just mowed him down. I do like he fights back, he throws some ornaments at him. And I will say that the couple of panels of Fats Morgan, he looks kind of like a Gil Kane character. He's got big lips and
Does.
yeah, he looks like a Gil Kane character.
That's a great call out. A top of seven in the middle of six. Yeah, I can see he's got the big nose there.
The last panel on page five, he really looks like a Gil Kane character. I mean,
Oh,
he's,
yeah.
it's an up the nose shot too, so.
That's a great call. I didn't notice that one. But of course, Batman hears the gunshot and he runs into the store. And this is some fun stuff going on here. Batman goes in, he crashes all the Christmas elf figurines, throws Christmas trees at the bad guys. And this I also thought was a little Marshall Rogers-esque, like at the top of page eight, although the figure doesn't look like Marshall Rogers at the bottom of eight, like his chest is too broad. But the sort of action and the kinetic movement there, it seemed to me a little bit more like Marshall Rogers. I don't know if you agree with that or not.
Yeah, again, the way he's handling the cape, you hear, is pretty Rogersy. It's in particular. I do like that he used, I guess it's like it's a Christmas tree with a wooden base, or maybe it's just a small tree. I don't know, but it looks like it would hurt if it hits you in the face.
Which, of course, at the top of page nine, it does. It hits the one guy, and then he asks the owner, "Where's Boomer?" And so Batman is able to take down all the bad guys, but Boomer and one other guy is outside, and the bad guy's got a gun to Boomer's head, his hands over his mouth. Speaking of Gil Kane, there's another up nose shot. And he says, "Not a peep, Boomer. You keep your mouth shut and you'll live a while longer, at least till these cops leave." Because there's two cops standing under the streetlight right outside the store where the nativity scene is. And you can see again, the bottom of nine, the left-hand side, you can see where the jewel or whatever that was the star has been broken out and stolen. So Batman comes out and says, "What's going on?" And the officers are like, "Well, I guess we'll be moving on." And you turn the page, and this is where I really thought Frank Miller. The first panel of the last page, you've got the light shining on Batman, so his cowl looks sort of almost white because such a bright light is shining on him. I don't know. I thought that looked like something from Out of the Dark Knight. And I don't know whether that's direction from Miller or the inker Steve Mitchell or even the colorist having to do with it, but that just immediately said to me, looks like Frank Miller.
I see his Daredevil work. Of course, he was already working on Daredevil at this point, but I can see kind of like his early Daredevil stuff there. But it's kind of funny. I think the way he's drawing Batman, particularly right there, looks like Dick Giordano's Batman to me.
Oh, it's a good point. That could be a Dick Giordano head for sure. I was more focused on the lighting, but yeah, I agree.
Who knows? Dick might have come in and redrew it. I think this was around the time he was coming back to work in the office and editorial. So, but yeah, it could be Frank, because it does look a lot like his Daredevil stuff too. And of course, an Adams influence, you know, and a Dick Giordano influence are very similar. So,
Yeah,
yeah.
right. The light, they're like, "Oh, the missing star, it's back." But of course, it's not the display star. It's the actual Star of Bethlehem, shines through the spot, illuminating the bad guy and Boomer. And Batman jumps up and clobbers the bad guy. Boomer's all right. He's like, that star, it's gone again. And he's gone on home, Boomer. And we see the star as it's the end of the story. Tight story, man. The logic's all there. You got a beginning, a middle, and an end. You understand the personalities and the characters. I don't know. I thought it's great.
Yeah, it's a perfect little Batman story. And just rereading this and just talking about it with you, I could see this, it could have very easily been adapted into Batman the Animated Series.
Sure. That would have been a great episode.
Or even one of the vignettes in the Holiday Nights episode that was the three, you know, Christmas New Year stories, because maybe it wasn't quite long enough. They'd had to pad it out for a half an hour. It's just, and it's, you know, it's touching. Unfortunately, I feel like Boomer's probably going back to jail for this because he still was involved in it. attempted robbery. I mean, maybe he's not. Maybe Batman will let this one go, vouch for him. Maybe
yeah, I'd like to think so.
Yeah.
It's Christmas.
Yeah. I hope so, too.
This is Bronze Age Batman, okay? Come on,
right.
Man.
That's true, yeah. He'll let him go.
I think Boomer's explanation is plausible. Like you said, we don't know how much he was really buying into it, how much he was convinced or coerced or whatever. That's a little murky. So I'm going to give Boomer the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, well, let's do that. I like that. Let's go with the Christmas spirit.
Well, Chris, this has been great fun. Thank you so much for coming back on DC Special Cast. You know, I've got to head to Florida, but I appreciate you coming on. So Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, Happy Holidays to you and your whole family. Hope to talk to you soon.
Same here, Paul. Thanks for having me. It was great to come to your Christmas party and be here with all your other illustrious guests. And Happy Holidays, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year to your family. And I hope you have a great one. And yes, I hope we get to podcast again in the coming year.
Absolutely. Take care. All right, now I'm going to leave Kentucky and head even further south to the untamed wilds of Florida to visit noted film and comic historian, former Phantom Stranger blogger, and most importantly, the Grand Poobah of the Fire and Water Network, Rob Kelly. Hey, Rob, welcome back to DC Special Cast.
Thank you, Paul. Happy to be back.
Rob, I know you recently wrapped up Mountain Comics, and so we're doing a little thing talking about Christmas comics here, not just comics with Christmas stories, but also any comics that remind you or you got around Christmas time. Any fun stories you have that you want to share about stuff like that?
I have to say, once I got out of being a little kid and getting toys, although that overlapped to being a quote-unquote adult.
When was that?
Yeah. Chris Franklin's like, what? What are you talking about? I've never been that big of a Christmas. I'm more of a birthday person. I go all out on my birthday, my wife's birthday, because to me, it's like that's special to the person. Christmas is sort of everybody. Although I will say one of my favorite movies of all time, like top four Letterboxd, is White Christmas. So right there, I'm kind of going against what I just said. But and there are some Christmas comics that I really genuinely like, a couple of one-offs. I did an episode of Tim Price's The Outcaster show talking mm-hmm. about the Christmas issue of Batman and the Outsiders.
Which is a great comic
book. Yeah, I love that issue so much. So there's a couple of examples, but generally, to be honest, when I think of Christmas comics, I think about, of course, my treasuries, my Christmas with the Superhero Treasury Edition. And actually, great news that, like, I think by the time this episode airs or close to it, DC will be releasing a facsimile edition.
Yeah.
Of the first Christmas with Superheroes. I'm very excited about that.
That's awesome. Well, thank you. So let's talk about our story. This story is an 8-pager. It doesn't actually have a title. It does come under the logo of the House of Mystery, but it's written by Bob Ruzakis and penciled by Romeo Tangle. Not inked, penciled by Romeo Tangle, which I found interesting, but inked by Dan Adkins. As far as I can tell, it's never been reprinted, but maybe they'll get to it in one of those DC Finest down the road. Rob, you want to do the honors and tell our listeners about the story?
Absolutely. So welcome to the weirdest Christmas party ever, the annual get-together of the hosts from DC's Mystery Comics. While waiting for an unnamed guest, they decide to have a contest to see who can tell the best Christmas story. The witches from The Witching Hour tell the story of a poor Florida family, hey, having a nice sail on their yacht. Wait a minute, a poor Florida family in their yacht? On Christmas Eve, like all of us Floridians do. But the weather turned bad and their yacht sank, so the family evacuated onto a lifeboat. It was so foggy that they could not see the shore, but finally they were able to guide their way to safety due to what they thought was a lighthouse. But of course, it was the Star of Bethlehem, since that is the theme of this issue. We get a better story from Kane of the House of Mystery as he tells of a dishonest jeweler, Jeremiah Podash, who has hoarded valuables for years after fleecing all of his customers. On Christmas Eve, a rather large, white-bearded man comes in and offers him the largest diamond in the world for the contents of the store. Podash agrees, but after he takes possession of the diamond, it turns to coal. Santa revs up his sleigh and ho-ho-hos out of there to deliver the jewels back to the families Podash has swindled. And finally, Destiny from the Secrets of Haunted House goes for a sci-fi story. He claims there was an alien who was chasing a UFO, but as he caught up, his ship exploded through the time barrier, creating the star seen every Christmas Eve on Earth. The group fights and argues, but finally, the Phantom Stranger and Madame Xanadu show up to put an end to the shenanigans. They remind the group that this is the season of peace and friendship, even for them. They all exchange gifts before the Phantom Stranger disappears again. The end.
So what'd you think of this little story, Rob?
Okay, it is the most thoroughly unmysterious story to possibly have, starring all of the mystery hosts. But it's obviously it's meant to be because they're Christmas stories with just a little sprinkling of mystery on top of it, right?
You know,
just
a little tiny twist.
Who was that? Yeah, just a tiny, oh, who is that? Now, it's colored to be unmysterious, right? Because it's like these day globe colors and stuff like that. And all the stories that the three hosts tell are stories from the culture. You know, I mean, I've heard the one about Haunted Lighthouse in like several different iterations. Bob Rozakis is taking bits from the culture and slamming it together. But for a little 8-pager that features everybody all together, it's cute. And I love, of course, the Phantom Stranger pops in. That's why when I used to have my Phantom Stranger blog, I covered this because it's like it counts as an appearance, even though he only appears in 2 panels of the entire story. But it's fun. You're not meant to, you know, really have any great judgment of it. It's like, oh, this is cute. They're all together. Great. All right, let's move on to the next story kind of thing.
Yeah. What'd you think of the art by Tangle and Atkins?
Yeah, it's funny. You mentioned that Romeo Tangle penciling. I can't think of that many examples where I've seen him as the penciler, not the inker. It's got a slight Joe Orlando energy to it, which I think fits with the, you know, the because he did horror comics, but his horror style was cartoony. Mm-hmm. So it's a little scary. That's not scary. It's a little horror-ish, but not really. I love in the splash page, the crazy road that you have to take to get to the House of Mystery. It's like, how the hell are you supposed to get onto that thing? I like them all together. One thing I noticed about this story was I always thought the habit that comic characters have now of when they say their name, that they stat in the logo was a more recent, that came in like the 80s, but it's right here, right? We've got the witches saying the witching hour, and we've got the House of Mystery, and we've got Destiny saying Secrets of Haunted House, and it's just the logo. So right here, they're doing it, you know, way ahead of what I thought they would have been doing it. So it was cute. And like I said, I love the fact that you actually don't even really see the Phantom Stranger. You see his mouth and a profile in shadow, and then that's it. So I kind of liked it. even in this story, he's just like super mysterious.
I like the art to it. I don't know if I ever told you this story. I met Romeo Tangle about 20 years ago, the one time I went to San Diego Comic-Con. And I got a little sketch of Starfire, and it looks very talented. It looks just like George Perez drew it, which makes sense because he inked over George Perez for so long. Yeah, let's just walk through real quick. The first page, you mentioned the splash is great. You've got Abel coming out of the House of Secrets. He's going to walk up the crazy path to the House of Mystery. And he gets there, and they're all there already. You got a Christmas tree. There's a stocking hanging there. And I love how they do stuff with all the Christmas accoutrements. Like later on, Cain and Abel are bashing each other with candy canes and stuff. I just think that's so funny.
I like that the one witch has a chicken bone that she's gnawing on a chicken bone in the second panel. The usual Christmas food, chicken. Okay, all right, sure.
I do like how they're all arguing, like they're in a big competition to see who's got the best comic book. First story I thought was a little dull. You know, they go out on the boat sinks, they see the star, they are saved. And okay, yes, you're right.
That's it.
Not much to it. And then that's when we see Cain says, get out of the way, and pushes Abel out of the way and says, hey, I'm going to tell the story of the second one, which I liked much better.
This feels like a Twilight Zone, one of the Christmassy Twilight Zone episodes. I can see this being done like that because it has that feel to it, criticizing the miser's greed and stuff like that. Yeah, I liked it.
Yeah, a little moral. A lot of those mystery stories had those kind of things. Oh, boy, don't act like this or else this bad thing's going to happen to you. Chris and I just did the ghost episode a couple of months ago now. And, you know, all the stories were like that. They have a little moral at the end. And you certainly know, first time you see the bearded guy with a red hat, you know it's Santa Claus from the very beginning.
Having been to a lot of antique stores, something my wife and I like to do, I think a lot of the stuff Santa's going to end up picking up from Podash are just old records. So I hope that the kids that he's distributing these to really like 70s records and Glenn Campbell and stuff, because it's a lot of records you find in antique stores nowadays.
And then bottom of 5 is where you get Abel throwing the candy canes at Cain, which I think is pretty funny. Then we move on to the third story. I never really read Secrets of the Haunted House. I don't really know how often they had like more of a sci-fi element to them, but I thought it was okay.
I don't think I've read a single issue of that book. I can't think of ever a time, even as a mountain comic, even when I was like buying everything. I can't recall. I know I bought Unexpected and House of Mystery and occasionally Ghost, but Secrets of Haunted House, I don't know if I ever never even saw it, right, on a stand or anything.
I don't think it ran that long. I'd have to look up how long it ran, but it didn't run as long as the others, of course.
On page 7, I really love the little shot of Destiny getting poked in the chest by Cynthia, because I love how pneumatic she is. Wow, she's really something. Like, like the slit on her dress, I'm like, geez, okay. Maybe I should have read The Witching Hour more. I don't know. It was really quite nice.
Practice for drawing Starfire, I guess, right?
I guess so, man.
And then we get the logo, like you say. And then we get the last page, and they're still arguing about who's the best. And then in comes the Phantom Stranger yelling, "Stop!" You know, I guess he's the boss of them all, right? And his date is Madame Xanadu. Like,
I love that they're like a pair. That's like, they're like the coolest couple, right? Ever. Because it's like, I dig. And I think that he leaves and leaves her there.
Yeah.
Like, she's still there when he disappears. I guess she's used to that, right? Yeah. She's like, all right, he's going to do his thing. It's fine. It's all right.
You know, the rest of them are such like losers.
Yeah.
He comes in and says, come on, guys, remember the whole reason for this. And so they get together, and the older witch that was eating at the beginning, she's like, whoa, wait, did somebody just hear ho, ho, ho? Like, she's waiting for Santa, which is awfully cute. So that's just a cute little story. Not much more to it.
No, I like Kane dumping the punch bowl on the witch's head on the last page. And she still got it on in the next to last panel. It's a fun detail. But yeah, it's just a cute little thing. It's really like, I'm sure when they slotted out all the stories and they were like, oh, we got 8 pages to fill. I did an interview many years ago with J.M. DeMatteis where he talked about that he thought it was good training to be a comic writer to have to learn to be short.
Right.
Right? Because you can't write everything to be a 6-issue epic. And this story is even more that. It's 8 pages with 3 other stories buried inside of it. So, you know, you got to have the skills to be like, I got 8 pages to fill. What can I do? All right. How about this, 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 and this? That gets us to 8 pages. We're done and we're moving on to the Legion or whatever. So it's cute. It's cute.
Well, in many ways, and part of the reason I think these logos are in there, right? It's a bit of a commercial for some of the mystery books, which were not on their last legs, but waning by the time 1979 was here, right? And they're like, Bob, we need to spotlight the mystery titles. Can you do something cute in 8 pages there to see if we can drum up any interest? I had some of the other DC specials with some of these characters in it, but I didn't even buy all them. And I bought this. I'm holding the copy I owned when I was, you know, a teenager. And this is, you know, one of the few that I had with those guys in it. Most of them were other anthologies where they showed up. Kind of does its job, I think.
Yeah. Absolutely.
All right. Well, any final thoughts? Otherwise, I'm going to head north.
You are traveling all around for the things you do for a single podcast. We all appreciate the commitment.
All right. Thanks, Rob. Happy holidays. Have a great Christmas and New Year's, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you very much. You too.
Okay, listeners. I am getting tired of all this jet setting. Good thing I've been using the Wayne Enterprises jet. Now we are way up in the wilds of New England, where I'm excited to have as my guest for the next story, Ryan Daly. Hey, Ryan, welcome back to DC Special Cast.
Thank you for having me back.
So we're talking Christmas comics. Any Christmas comics in your past that you want to mention before we get started with Sergeant Rock?
In terms of comics, probably the one that I like most, just last Christmas, a year ago, I was on Shag's Christmas episode of Justice Society Presents, where he and I talked about a story that was part of the Sandman Mystery Theater comic, which sort of kind of roundabout way led to me doing the Sandman Mystery Theater coverage on Justice Society Presents The Sandman Slept Here, which you, Paul, might be familiar with. Also, if listeners want to go back several years, maybe 6 or 7 years, I'm sure it was an episode of Find Your Joy on FW Presents. Me and Kyle Benning covered Ant-Man's Big Christmas, which was a special issue, double-sized issue featuring one of my favorites, Hank Pym, the Ant-Man with the Wasp, saving a little boy from the Christmas with his family, otherwise known as the one good Ant-Man comic.
That's awesome. Well, thanks for sharing those. So we are here to talk about the fourth story in the book. It's entitled The Longest Night. It's a 10-pager and stars Sergeant Rock at Easy Company, written, of course, by Robert Kaniger, with pencils by Dick Ayers and inks by Romeo Tangal. Now, Romeo Tangal did the pencils in the last story, but now we're doing the inks in this story. As far as I can tell, this story has never been reprinted. Ryan, would you like to do the honors and tell our listeners how the story goes?
I would be honored. It's Christmas Eve, and Sergeant Rock leads the men of Easy Company through the woods of northern Italy, blazing a trail for General Patton's tanks to follow. Easy's mission is to clear the town of Santa Maria of German troops within the next 24 hours in anticipation of Patton's arrival. It's so dark that Rock depends on a special radium compass to navigate through the woods, but that compass is shot right out of his hand by a German sniper. Easy quickly takes out the enemy sharpshooter, but without the compass, they're lost. Now, if you've been paying attention to the other stories in this comic, you might expect an appearance by the Star of Bethlehem. And you'd be right. Sergeant Rock, however, mistakes it for the North Star and has Easy Company keep it on their left since they need to march east to Santa Maria. En route, the soldiers come upon a candlelit procession led by a nun who tells Easy that her people are following the star to the shrine in Santa Maria. Their ancestors did this, and they have kept the tradition every year since, and not even the danger posed by an active war zone will make them break with tradition this Christmas. Begrudgingly accepting that the nun and her people will not be deterred, Sergeant Rock orders Easy Company to follow the star on the double. They don't just have to clear Santa Maria for Patton's Third Army, they need to secure the town for the unarmed civilians that night. As clouds enshroud the star, Easy sneaks into the city under the cover of darkness, systematically eliminating enemy threats. Rock finds an orphan boy named Mario who refuses to leave his side. Ignoring Rock's insistence that he seek shelter somewhere else, Rock and Mario are nearly ambushed by the last squad of German soldiers hiding out in the remains of the shrine. Rock saves himself and the boy and takes out the enemy squad, but in the process destroys the only remaining part of the shrine, the statue of Mary. The worshippers arrive to pray, and the nun alleviate Sergeant Rock's guilt. The shrine was just a building, after all. As the light from the star breaks through the clouds, they proclaim that their hearts are the real shrines, and that their love can light up the world.
Excellent. Thank you. So what'd you think of this story overall? To start big picture first.
I like it. Without getting into too many of the details, this story does a thing that I find very fascinating in a lot of war tales, which is bringing non-combatants into the story and forcing the soldiers to kind of conform to the moral code of the non-combatants rather than the other way around, as you might expect. We see this in the movie Saving Private Ryan. The whole movie, their mission is to go and find this guy. They get to him. They're like, we got to take you back. And he's like, no, I can't leave my squad. I can't leave my team. We've got to defend this town. And the guys are forced to, you know, make a decision. What do? Do we leave and say mission failure, or do we stay and help this guy? They're the ones with guns because their job is to kill people. You need a kind of moral flexibility, even if you believe absolutely that you are doing right, you're killing in the name of freedom or your country, whatever your purpose is. To get to that place, you need to divorce yourself from your own possible moral compass, your code, your ethics. And I just love it that the people who are the most vulnerable, the people without arms, are willing to say, no, we're not compromising. We're not going to change our morality, our ethics. You have to bend around us. And I just think it's fascinating. And that's kind of in a very micro way that that's something that this story does when they find this group of parishioners, the processional.
No, I agree. I do like it when they have that sort of human side of Sergeant Rock. I mean, he does away with plenty of folks in this one, but their mission became more urgent in some way because they had a quicker deadline so that these people would be safe. So I thought that was a pretty neat aspect. I like the art throughout. I like Dick Ayers. I like Romeo Tango both. And I think they do a good job on this. It's not Kubert, right? But it's still pretty good.
Right. Kubert has such a recognizable and distinct style that if you don't draw that way, it's going to look jarring unless you're really making a point of this is a different interpretation of Sergeant Rock. But I think this one is in the realm of that. Like, he's recognizable. I'm like, oh yeah, this is Sergeant Rock. It may not be Kubert, but I can recognize this guy. I see who it is and I buy it.
I love the splash page. I don't know about you. This first page, I'll definitely include this in the gallery, but it's basically a calendar of December, but there are inset pictures throughout of Sergeant Rock or Easy Company doing different things, and talks about combat was just a letter in the alphabet. K for K rations or killing. I'm like, whoa, and they're eating K rations in one. Rock is pulling the dog tags off of somebody who's died in another one. He's throwing a grenade in another one. He's shooting in the inside of a German tank in another one. He's putting a helmet on top of the gun for a grave of another one. Just a really tremendous splash page, I thought. I don't know about you.
I love it too. It reminds me of the Super DC calendars that they would they printed around this time. Like, they would always have the month, and if it was somebody's birthday on April 17th or something, they would have a picture of that person in that date, and that kind of layout kind of reminds me of that.
And then we move on and we get the scene where the compass is shot out of Rock's hand by the sniper. That's a pretty good shot in the dark by the sniper. He should have gone for Rock, but I guess that wasn't his mission. But Rock takes care of him pretty quick, shoots back up into the tree, Buddha, 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 and the guy falls out of the tree. It's funny how his gun on top of H3 has got a swastika on the butt end of the gun, which I don't think they made him that way, but that just let us know he's a bad guy.
That's how you know he's evil.
Then the clouds sort of part and they see the star. And he's like, oh, that must be the North Star. And they start off in the wrong direction, which I think is interesting. But then lift up your socks. I'm not familiar with that phrase. Have you ever heard that one?
No, I'm trying to think.
And it's with an X. Lift up your socks, easy. The war's this way. Anyway, I like the smoke that's coming out of Rock's cigar in that panel. It just looks cool for sure. And then we get the sort of the part that you were talking about where they encounter the processional led by the nun. And I really like the silent panel in the second panel. Mm-hmm. Got the nun sort of in the front and all the townspeople behind her. And they're all carrying candles and they're sort of marching through. And they said, where are you going, sister? And then she tells them and he's like, go back. It's going to be a rough spot here pretty soon. She's like, yeah, we've done this for hundreds of years. We're not stopping now. And that's sort of the part you were talking about.
Yeah, I'm glad that you singled out that silent panel too, just because the image, but also kind of like the idea of that image of this candlelit processional through the woods, this silent, snowy woods. There's something kind of haunting and also beautiful about it. And it reminds me, and this is not a war movie, in a way it is, in The Lord of the Rings, when Frodo and Samwise see the parade of the elves leaving Middle Earth, and because of their natural glow about them, they just see them because in this dark forest, it's just these people kind of glowing as they're kind of moving out. And they're like, it's almost funereal, kind of beautiful, but also a little bit unsettling.
Yeah, no, I hear you. At the bottom of the page, he goes, if we live to reach the shrine, we will certainly pray for you and your men, Sergeant. And Rock's like, double time easy on top of the next page. He's like, now we got to get there before them and make sure it's clear so that they're safe. Let's head towards the star. Let's see what happens next. So we're on page 5. They get to the town. And then it gets dark again. The clouds go back over the star. And I think it's funny. He goes, my combat antennas buzzing me. Top of page 6. Now, I haven't read enough Sergeant Rock. I've read a number of them. I don't remember hearing about his combat antennas. It's almost like a Spidey sense.
Yeah, yeah, really fun.
Then he says, there's krauts in the bakery and they're not baking bread. And he throws his grenade. And then we see him blowing up more Nazis in the ruined building. And then he sees something moving in the cellar and he starts shooting, but he stops. And thank goodness he does, because there's a boy. He's of indeterminate age because he's not very tall, but he looks pretty grown up at the top right-hand part of page 7. He looks teenagery, but everywhere else, he seems to be like 9 or 10, if you ask me. I don't know. Feeling how old do you think that this kid is?
No, it's sort of like when John Byrne drew a kid. It's just a grown-up's head on a smaller body.
I mean, he looks like a kid. In the very next panel, he's clearly smaller, but his face even looks a little more boyish, but I agree with you. It's tough to draw the kids. You know, these artists, they have a tough time with it. But then the kid, speak of another one who Rock is forced to adapt to. This kid starts tagging along with Rock. And Rock, get out of here. Go somewhere safe. You know, and he's like, no, I'm hanging around with you. And Rock, and Rock tries to shake him and takes out another sniper. And then he comes around the corner and the boy's there. He's taking a shortcut because he knows a shortcut. And he's like, got a cigarette, Joe? I thought that was pretty funny.
I'm like, that Rock's like, you're too young to smoke. Here, have some chocolate. And I was like, chocolate? That's for kids. Like,
yeah, that's great. And so then there was an interesting part because there's a big artillery gun on the other side of the statue of Mary. And Rock yells, it's a Kraut 88, the Widowmaker, get down. And so I looked this up, being who I am. And a Widowmaker is typically a plane, the B-26 Marauder, an American plane. They called it the Widowmaker. But Rock also mentions the German 88.
Yeah.
This was an artillery. It's also known as the FLAK, F-L-A-K. I think that's what this is. I don't know if you know anything about, or if Captain Entropy, I don't know if he knows much about artillery weapons as opposed to Air Force stuff.
No, there was a different Easy Company in Band of Brothers, which was a book by Stephen Ambrose and adapted into an HBO miniseries. I love the show. I also read the book. That squad, Easy Company, of the 501st Paratroopers, their mission is they go behind enemy lines so they can take out these Kraut idiots that are shelling the beach at Normandy during the D-Day invasion.
Right.
So these things were basically this destructive wave of these cannons were just wiping out all of the soldiers who were landing on the beach. And the other Easy Company, not Sergeant Rock's, but Captain Winter's Easy Company, had to go in and take out the Germans with these 88s in order to clear the way for the advancement. Yeah, these were real deal cannons that did a lot of damage.
Yeah, so he knows he needs to take it out. He yells, eat dirt, Mario, keep your head down and pray for a miracle. And he goes, there's no miracle here. This is a kid who's had his parents killed. You know, there's no miracle. He doesn't care that it's Christmas, that kind of stuff. And then Rock gets wind. winged, apparently, but he's able to toss a grenade. And one grenade took out a lot in this panel in the middle of page 9. The statue, the cannon, all, like 1, 2, 3, 4, 4 or 5 guys. That's a lot of damage from one grenade, but I guess if you pop it at the right spot.
Yeah, the grenade must have hit like their munitions supply or something, and just all of their shells just explode at once.
Yeah. So then he's like, the Paisans can come in and pray for a miracle at their shrine. And the boys tell him, hey, there's no shrine. The statue was the shrine. You blew it up. And Rock's like, oh, sorry. You know, I didn't know. But then the procession shows up and their candles have kind of burned out and they're all dark and everything's dark. Mm-hmm. And then poof, the clouds part again and the star comes out again. The whole sky blazing like a giant flare. And now the boy's like, it's a miracle. And we get a nice little ending from the nun. He says, no, Bambino, the miracle's in the skies. Our hearts are the shrines. And so I thought that was a nice way to end it. We end with the soldiers and the townspeople looking up at the star with the ruins all around them. I thought it was a nice way to end this little mission that they had.
Mm-hmm. It's a nice little poignant ending. It's very peaceful. They achieved their mission, but they also, there's a kind of perhaps a spiritual catharsis that is coupled with the physical achievement of beating the bad guys. So,
yeah. So overall, any final thoughts on this story, Ryan?
No, I'm glad you had me on to talk about this one. I don't get a chance to talk about Sergeant Rock ever, and I've only read a handful of Rock comics, but this was kind of intriguing. I was like, let me exercise some other muscles that I'm not used to talking about something. And maybe talking about G.I. Joe Brett Young for so long that maybe fueled something in me. It's like, I need to get out a little bit more of my military knowledge, like I'm such a military expert.
No, that was great. Well, I appreciate you. Thank you very much for coming back to DC Special Cast, celebrate the holidays with me. I'll talk to you soon. I'm going to head back home and finish up with the last story in the book coming up with Sean.
Thank you. Happy holidays.
Whew. Man, that was an exhausting trip. I'm glad to be back home. Are you all rested up for the story, Sean?
La, 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 la. Yes, I am.
All right. Well, you do the honors. Tell us what story we're going to talk about.
Our story is Starlight, Star Bright, Farther Star I See Tonight. It's 12 pages featuring the Legion of Superheroes, and those superheroes are Lightning Lad, Mon-El, Phantom Girl, Saturn Girl, Superboy, and Wildfire. It was written by Paul Levitz. The penciler was Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, inked by Dick Giordano. And it was reprinted in The Best of DC number 11 in 1981, Superheroes number 15 in 1981, Christmas with the Superheroes number 1 in 1988, the DC Universe Christmas trade in 2001, and the Legion of Superheroes Before the Darkness Volume 2 hardcover in 2022. Starlight, Starbright, Farther Star I See Tonight. On Christmas Eve, circa 1963, by the way, I had to do math to figure that out, and for that, I will never forgive Paul. Superboy leaves Smallville to visit his pals in 2979 at Legion headquarters, currently undergoing refurbishment. Walking down the barely decorated hallways, like, couldn't they just go to the dollar store to get more decorations? But I guess in the 30th century, dollar stores would be like $60 stores. And gosh darn it, that's 2 times I had to use math for this synopsis. And I swear to Kris Kringle, if I have to do math again, I am walking off of this show. Phantom Girl puffs in to sneak a kiss from Superboy under the mistletoe. He certainly could afford that decoration. Then they meet up with Saturn Girl, and after discussing how the Legion feels like home to her and Garth, the two Legion lasses take Superboy on a trip around the world, showing off different holiday and non-holiday customs via a 60-foot, 124K resolution screen that used to be used to show the Wizard of Oz in Las Vegas. Wildfire joins the group just in time to hear Superboy complain about how different Christmas is now compared to when he was a little kid, and how we all know that Christmas is a big commercial racket. It's run by a big Eastern syndicate, you know. But that makes him think back to the original Christmas and asks the Legionnaires if they've ever gone looking for the star. We have a theme. Off they fly with Garth, piloting to the point where the star is supposed to be, but only find a lonely little planet. Since they came all this way anyway, what the hey, what do you say? Let's make a day of it and go explore. Once landed, they find an aquatic race of creatures who live on a plankton kind of food, but that food is freezing. A land-based race of creatures who are burning their own crops to stop from freezing, and, in the rule of three, a bird-like race whose nest homes are being destroyed by freezing rain. The heroes help each race separately, but when they get together to compare notes, they realize that the planet will not last long enough for evacuation arcs to help them out. After a huge light bulb strikes Superboy in the head, the Legionnaires 4, hey, it's only just now doing this synopsis that I realize Dream Girl doesn't go planet side. They rework the planet's topography so that each race can contribute something to another race's survival, so that every race can live long enough for the help to arrive. On the way back to the ship, Superboy can honestly bring a tear to my eye when he says that Christmas is really all about caring and helping.
So, Sean, I know this story is very special to you. We can walk through it beat by beat, but maybe you want to give us an overall thought before we do that?
I get to kind of like have my cake and eat it too, because I say this is my favorite story, and this is my all-time favorite comic book story ever. But I also get to say that JLA 200 is my favorite issue, because I love that too. Because JLA 200 is a big issue, so I get to say that's my favorite issue. Now, the tough thing is, I don't know that you could really hand JLA 200 to someone who has never read a comic book in their life, and they would get as much out of it. We get it because it's the old JLA and the new JLA, and it's done in the style where they would go off into different groups and then come back together. So we appreciate that. The thing I love about this story is a couple of things. First of all, you could give this to anybody who has never read a comic book in their life, and you don't have to know anything about the Legion or their powers or anything.
Despite the fact that it's about the Legion, which is the most complicated group around.
Exactly. Yeah. You don't need to know a single thing and you can get the meaning of the story. This story is great because it is about helping people, and that's what we have to do. There were times where I didn't have a lot to eat and people helped me out with that. There were times where I felt down and lonely and people helped me. There were times that I didn't have a job and people helped me find a job. I am so thankful for those people. Like, I know I'm putting a lot of emotion in this, but it's true. Just the same way that those three races have to come together. But also, it's not just that. It's that there's an outside force, not force, there's an outside existence that is bringing these people together. And when I say outside existence, I am not religious at all. I would say I am either agnostic or atheist, somewhere in there. But I do think that there is something that we have to come together and help each other. Helping people is what makes you feel good. It is good for you. It is good for that other person. It is good for everyone around you if you help someone. So let's get into the story so that I can make a joke about some dumb thing.
All right, fair enough. So we have this beautiful splash page where Superboy is flying through the portal. I love how you can see Smallville back through the small circle at the top left. And then he sees the Legion building under construction. And it's just a beautiful image. I always thought it was weird when I was a kid. It's Christmas Eve in Smallville in whatever year, and he has to travel to Christmas Eve in 2979. He could go to any date he wants, right? And so that's the only thing that always ever got me about the Legion of Superheroes. Again, it's Christmas. We'll allow it. You can understand he's a teenager. He's celebrating Christmas with his family. Hey, he wants to go see his friends at Christmas too. He can do both. He's just time travel. Why not?
You didn't know you did this, but you segged perfectly into what I was going to talk about, because it's Christmas Eve. That doesn't mean it's Christmas Eve when you time travel. But the first time I read this story, it was not Christmas. It was in the year's best digest stories. Best of DC Digest number 11, year's best digest stories. That's when I read it. So it wasn't around Christmas time at all. So that kind of like hammers home the point that it doesn't have to be Christmas Eve. And I think too, the first time I read this, I'm like, well, so did he just leave Ma and Pa Kent alone on Christmas Eve? But the great thing about time travel is, you know, let's say he did leave Smallville, we'll say like 10 o'clock, 10:00:01. Well, then when he time traveled back, he just came back to 10:00:02. So he only left it for a second. So that's good. But yeah, that's exactly like the time travel aspect of it.
But yeah, it's a beautiful page. And then we move on and you see Superboy say hi to Mon-El. He goes through the sparsely decorated, but he comes upon the mistletoe. And it's just really cute how Phantom Girl comes out of the wall and plants a little kiss on his cheek. They're chatting. He says, "Oh, I'm sorry if I surprised you." But he's like, "Hey, I don't know if Ultra Boy ever makes you apologize for kissing him. But if he does, you can tell him from me that he's crazy." So it's just cute.
What you were saying with his artwork, these look like teenagers. Like, you can look at this and you can see that it's not Superman. Now, I will say they look like 17, 18, 19 years old. Yeah, they don't look like 13 or 14.
They're clearly mature, but they're kind of prime.
Yeah.
Once you hit the other side of 30, you start going downhill, right? So then you see Saturn Girl sitting at the monitor. Of course, they have monitor duty in the 30th century as well.
And I want to talk about this panel. So obviously, this is Jose Luis Garcia Lopez. But this does equal almost like a George Perez. Look at the machinery.
Yeah.
Look at all this machinery that he did not have to draw, but he did. You can just go in-depth and in-depth and in-depth and in-depth with all this technology.
There's other chairs in the room. There's other monitors. And kudos to Dick Giordano for inking all that stuff. You got two masters here, Garcia Lopez and Giordano. Superboy's like, "I don't get it. Why you always volunteer for extra duty on Christmas Eve?" And she goes into, "Hey, the Legion's my family. This is where I want to be. I want to be around my family." Which makes sense. And then we get the montage scene. So why don't you talk about that, Sean?
Oh my God, I love this because this TV screen is huge. And I love it and I want it. They're standing there and the figures on the screen are probably like twice or three times as big as they are. Yeah. It's like the whole wall. And they get to see all the different Christmas and non-Christmas and non-holiday things going on around the world. You have Karate Kid, Princess Projectra, and Sun Boy in Japan. And Karate Kid is like sharing his tradition. You have Chameleon Boy, his world of Durla, where Christmas isn't a holiday at all. You have the fireworks trees display on Snarl.
I thought that was kind of random. There's no Legionnaire in that one. I'm like, but I like
now,
it.
Now, I will say, you can't really tell kind of, like they're kind of like pinkish magenta creatures, but their outfits look like Green Lantern Corps bib overall bell bottoms, and I love that. You have Colossal Boy, and I do love that Colossal Boy is in his outfit at home on Hanukkah,
and he's also a giant size.
And Legion followers, I don't know like how tall Colossal Boy canonically can be. So I don't know if he's 18 feet tall. I don't know if he's 10 feet tall, whatever. But he is huge. Like, he's big enough in his regular just form, but he's wearing his costume. And I do love that.
Then Superboy goes a little cranky on us about, "Oh, what about a simple old fashioned with a real tree and all?" I love the bottom of page 4 where Superboy gets excited and he looks like a teenager who just got an idea. And he's like, "I got a great idea. Let's go search for the Star of Bethlehem," which is something Superman wouldn't do. I've never been the hugest Superboy fan. I've read plenty of Superboy stories over the years, but he never was as interesting to me as Superman for some reason. But I love it when he acts age appropriate. And I think this is just something that an excited teenager would say, who's got access to all these resources. They hop on their starship and head out to where the star is, saying, "Hey, we should be able to find it. It's the 30th century. We can get to another star in no time flat." I just love that whole concept. I love the image at the bottom of page 4 where he's so excited. I don't know. I just love that.
Yeah, his expression on page 4 is fantastic. On page 5, the second panel, where the Legion is in their ship, the body language of the Legionnaires is just so fantastic. Wildfire, who you can't see his face at all, he has his head in his hand, and you see his like shoulders are slumped over, and he's like, he's just...
What a waste of time.
Yeah, and then like Garth and Imra. Oh,
they're like the parents.
They're punching the keys on the keyboard. They're doing all that. Phantom Girl's just like bemused. And then even like Garth's expression two panels later. Like, it's so good.
Yeah. Because they get there and they're like, "There's no star here. What's going on?" And there's no sign of a star ever been here. But all that's in my scope is a lonely little planet, not a star. Now, I don't know how the planet can exist and have life on it without a star nearby, but we'll let that one go, Mr. Levitz, because then they go check out the three races. So why don't you describe the first one?
They must have loved that pink magenta color because these creatures, they're definitely aquatic. They have long tails, like fins on top of their heads. And you see that there are creatures of different sizes, which definitely would make you think like a family.
Yep.
And they are on almost like an iceberg, like a little tiny iceberg. But then they do have bowls and they're like pellets, like either grapes or green pellets or something like this that they're trying to eat. But it's all frozen inside of a different iceberg. So Wildfire lifts it all the way up in the sky, uses his power, breaks it up, and then all of the food falls from the sky. And again, the expressions on their faces, they're so happy to have this food falling down for them.
And he makes a good point at the end. He says, hey, this will help them for a couple of days, but they're about to enter an ice age. How can we help them overall? So then we see Lightning Lad and Phantom Girl go to the second race. There's a bunch of bonfires, so they're trying to stay warm. But in order to stay warm, the only thing that they can burn are their crops. So they go in, they save some of the creatures and try to help them get warm. But then again, they're like, how can we help them long term?
And this race really looks cool because they kind of remind me of blue creatures from Where the Wild Things Are.
Oh,
They're very furry and have like big, almost deer horns.
that's funny. I saw in my head the little creatures that were in Atari Force, which of course was drawn mostly at the beginning by Garcia
Oh,
Lorca,
yeah.
especially the bottom left on page 7 when he's in the fire and he's screeching. I haven't read that for ages, but it sort of reminded me of that creature that was in that comic.
The third race is bird creatures, yellow with red, like fantastically big red wings. Their nests in the trees are being battered by the winds and the sleet and the snow. I think it's an ice storm. It's an ice storm that's breaking apart the trees and their nests. But Superboy gets into the ground of the planet and creates metallic ores. Out of the metallic ores, he creates cables to lash the nests into the trees.
But again, this is only a short-term solution. Again, talking about body language, middle of page 9, they're sort of standing on a hill overlooking the settlements of the three races. And he's like, what can we do? We couldn't get the evacuation arcs here soon enough to get these races off the planet. And so then Superboy comes up with an idea. He asks all of the Legionnaires to give him their telepathic earplugs, which was a thing.
Actually, I'm going to go back just a little bit because we've been rightfully praising the artwork. But the four Legionnaires are kind of sitting like on an outcropping, and the sun is coming up, and they're looking at the scene. Wildfire says, "Pretty picture, isn't it?" And Superboy says, "Of death, maybe." Oh my God. Like, it's just, ugh.
Like you said, we can't even see Wildfire's face, but you know what they're thinking. They're all depressed that they know that they've helped them, but they've only delayed the inevitable. So Superboy has this idea. He grabs their telepathic earpieces, sort of like the universal translator on Star Trek, and he wants to use it that way.
And I want to bring up, literally on my Christmas list are the new AirPods, which supposedly do live translations of different languages.
That's cool.
Best thing about this is now I can hear Amante talking to his sister in Tagalog to see if they're talking about me.
Good spy craft. Superboy, first, he has Lightning Lad and Phantom Girl sort of carve out a subterranean cavern for a bunch of the aliens to come. Superboy gives them the earplugs and creates a way for the three races to communicate, which apparently they've never been able to do before. And he brings them all into the cavern. And why don't you tell us what the solution that he came up with, Sean?
So I'm going to read it word for word because that's the best way to describe it. So Superboy's talked to each of the chiefs of the three main species. These are the clan chiefs of the three races, and this cavern will be their common home. Because we sheltered it and gave it access to warm underground springs, the water dwellers can grow their crops here in safety, which they'll share with the land dwellers in trade for the land dwellers setting fires around the pool's edge to add to their warmth. And the bird-like species can contribute the wood for the fires from their trees in trade for the shelter for the young during the great storms. Alone, none of these three races could survive, but together they should be able to hang on until the United Planets can arrange a safe evacuation.
Yeah, and then Phantom Girl says, gee, and we made that possible just by being here. And why were they there in the first place, Sean?
To look for the star, but the
Yeah.
star wasn't there, or was it?
And that's where he says, this is what Christmas is supposed to do, Phantom Girl. It's caring, helping, and maybe a brightly shining star in the sky that science says is impossible. So then they go back to the starship, and Superboy gets his real tree, and he's putting the star on top of the tree, And we get a happy holidays from all of us to all of you as a very happy ending. Fantastic.
And I love this because Wildfire is saying, I'm not saying it was anything more than Lightning Lad and a bum navigational computer Superboy, but I guess I can't say it wasn't either.
Yep.
And that's kind of like where I land. Like, I don't know if I believe or don't believe or not, but this saved those three races. So that's what it is.
It's a good thing no matter what. Great story. You know, all these stories are great, but of course this is, as you can tell from how many times it's been reprinted, between this and the Batman stories are just classics and will continue to be reprinting.
It literally was one of the year's best comic stories.
We wouldn't be doing our job, though, if we didn't make a quick run through of what else we had in this issue. There's a bunch of pages and ads that Sean and I actually covered on Batman Family Reunion. We're not going to talk about those now. There's a Corgi ad on the inside front cover. There's a Sea Monkeys ad. The center spread is a 1941 John Belushi movie two-page ad. I remember we talked about that for quite a while.
Yeah.
The back cover is a Star Trek The Motion Picture. I know we talked about that. But there were a few new ones we haven't discussed. So do you want to tell us about your favorite kind of ad first, Sean?
Absolutely. Martin, you can go out and do your Christmas cracker because we're going to talk about, well, it's actually not Twinkies, but we're going to talk about a Hostess ad. Hawkman makes a safe landing. And man, it doesn't get much more simpler than this. There's a parachutist and his chute does not open. So Hawkman catches him. But maybe he brought the wrong pack because his pack is filled with Hostess cupcakes. I don't know, maybe.
I love it. It's like, and then all the parachutists at the bottom are like, oh, let's all have a Hostess pack. And the page after that, we get a fantastic full page ad. It's a double celebration. DC, the 200th issue of Superman Family, and the 17th wedding anniversary of Clark Kent and Lois Lane. So it's a 20 years in the future storyline. Sean, have at it. I know you love this comic book.
I absolutely love Superman Family. I got this off of the newsstand. I've told this story where I thought it was in the ad for Superman Family 200 that it said reserve your copy at the newsstand, because that made me think that's the only way you can get it. So I told Mom to call the newsstand, and then when she came home with a comic, I remember there was a piece of paper clipped to the cover, and it said, Joy, I think this is the comic that Sean was talking about.
I love that. That's a great one. What else do we have? Sean talked about the Adventure Comics. There is a half-page ad for that after page 4 of the Sergeant Rock.
It's like a 1/3 page ad, and it's the cover of number 489, what we talked about before. And the neat thing about this is it has the image of Starman from the cover, but he's literally like flying off of the cover. He's on the other side of the page.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty cool. I smell Bob Ruzakis and an X-Acto knife in the production room for this ad. Right on the next page, we get another full page ad, this time for World's Finest Dollar Comic subscription. And this is a fantastic cover. I think it's Joe Staton. Certainly Black Canary at the bottom looks like Joe Staton. I think Batman and Hawkman.
Definitely
Batman
Aquaman,
look like Joe Staton. So I'm pretty sure it's Joe Staton. For some reason, Captain Marvel has a perm, but it's a great ad for World's Finest. And you get 6 issues for the price of 5. I'm like, now that's a deal, right?
And then kind of in the same style, right around this time, DC was really like pushing their subscription. Isamu, if you are listening, do not do this. I would like to see all of the subscription pages that were done like this. It's like a full page ad. Down in the corners, the little cutout box. I guess every title had this. So the titles I was reading, I saw, but certainly whatever, like House of Mystery or any of those titles, I never saw. But I'd be interested in seeing. Isamu, do not do this research. If you know of a link where someone already did it, I will accept that. So help me, Kris Kringle. If you collect all of these, I will be mad at you and you will get coal in your stockings. Don't do that. But the Legion one, I do love the Legion and I've started to collect their stories. I haven't gotten all of them yet. And I think I'm pretty good. I'm not going to read off all of the characters because I will count them off quick. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24. There's 24 characters. And I don't even think that that's all of the Legionnaires.
Superboy's not on there.
Oh, yeah. However, Tie Rock is represented, and that's kind of all I care about. It looks great.
You got two different male heroes with shorts, Tie Rock and...
Oh, yeah, Cosmic Boy, yeah.
Last but not least, we have the Daily Planet, which was the house ad that ran in DC Comics. And this is volume 79, so it's 1979, issue number 48. Sean, you want to run through what's on this page?
Absolutely. So the headline is that Scalp Hunter Flees Rebels is from Weird Western Tales, number 65. There's a direct currents, and that tells us that the Adventure Comics that we talked about was on sale. House of Mystery, number 278. Legion of Superheroes, 261. The New Adventures of Superboy, number 3. Sergeant Rock, 338. There's a little like inset, which is just Warlord Finds Hidden Crypt of Gold. So it tells us about that, and that's Warlord, number 31. There is a Bob Rozakis Ask the Answer Man column, and those are just fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Down in the corner, there is a Hembeck comic strip, and as a present to you, we are going to start our initial episode of Hembeck Theater, starring Paul and Sean. I will be taking the role of Jimmy Olsen.
And I'll be Lois Lane. Jimmy, where's Perry?
He quit the planet and ran off to Las Vegas to become a stand-up comedian.
Great, Caesar's Palace.
I'll say, and scene. Thank you. That was great fun. That was a lot of great fun.
That was a lot of fun.
Incredibly fun. That was really cool and fantastic. And I think I could talk about that a lot.
You could? Well, guess what, listeners? It's finally time for our special announcement. Sean and I have certainly been itching to get back together to do some podcasting, but for various reasons, a full monthly show is not in the cards right now for us, but we are going to be doing a segment together every month right here on DC Special Cast. Think of it as like a backup story. So Sean, do you want to talk about our plans?
In May of 1976, DC began a beloved series of house ads known as the Daily Planet. I'm sure everyone who is listening to this has seen them many times. We just discussed this one from 1979. This feature ran every week in the back pages of DC Comics until 1981. Over the years, there were several popular features in this newspaper. For example, The Answer Man by Bob Rozakis and the Fred Hembeck comedy strips. So, starting in May of 2026, Paul and I will be starting a 50-year anniversary segment called The Monthly Planet. In this segment, every month, Paul and I will discuss four or five issues of the Daily Planet, the weekly issues of the quote-unquote newspaper that corresponds to that month 50 years ago. It's almost like we're time traveling at the exact same time, but we're coming back. We will talk about what comics we read back in those days of our youth and today. But... me being the blabbermouth, we didn't want to wait until May to start podcasting together again. So, since this is DC Special Cast, we want to do something special to whet your appetite before May. One of our favorite running storylines from 1976 was the Calculator Saga, which ran in Detective Comics 463 to 468. We are going to use our time from January to April to cover that run written by our bat cousin, Bob Rozakis, and art by the likes of Mike Grell, Ernie Chan, and Marshall Rogers. So specialers, all of that was pre-written by Paul, and he did a great job.
Uh-oh, he's gone off script now.
I have an idea that I am literally going to present to Paul right now. He has not heard this. This is like Saturday Night Live where they write jokes for each other. So I have an idea for a name for this segment, and Paul can say yay or nay. Specialers, you can write in if you think this is good. My idea for the name for the calculator segment is... catch you later, calculator. So, specialers, let us know if you like that. If it's dumb, Paul thought of it. Stay tuned for catch you later, calculator, starting next month on DC Special Cast.
All right. I think that's about it for this comic. And I think we know the answer to the question I've asked everybody, Sean. Does this comic live up to its special billing?
No, it's not special. It is one of the year's best comic stories. So it's special. Special.
Yeah, no, there's no question. This is a great comic book. Great package altogether. Just fantastic. So, Sean, thank you so much for covering this comic. It was great to finally record with you again. And I'm looking forward to covering all those Daily Planets and catch you later, calculator.
I want everyone to have a happy and safe and wonderful holiday. Thank you very much.
And so now I'm going to play a promo. And when I return, I will read and respond to your listener feedback for our last episode. Science fiction, romance, swashbuckling adventure, all that and more is coming to DC Special Cast in 2026. I'm your host, Paul Ken. DC Special Cast is a podcast where each month a guest and I explore DC's special comics of the 1970s, like DC Special Series, DC Superstars, Super DC Giant, and others. This year, we'll have plenty of superhero action, including a special movie tie-in. But we also plan to cover Sergio Aragonés, The Star Hunters, Three Musketeers, and Love 1971.
But wait, there's more! Extra! Extra! Read all about it! I'm Sean M. Myers, and because Paul will not let me do a podcast about Newsies, we're going to do a special segment we are calling The Monthly Planet. I will join my Bat Brother Paul as we cover the 50th anniversary of the greatest series of DC House ads ever, The Daily Planet. Get ready to hear us talk about Direct Currents, Fred Hembeck, The Answer Man, and so much more.
So join us each month on DC Special Cast from the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Now that's special.
Okay, welcome back. I hope everybody enjoyed that holiday spectacular. That was a lot of fun. Now we've got our next episode announcement. In January, I am thrilled to be joined by the co-host of the Earth 2 podcast, Peter Watson. That is a great show, and if you've never listened to it, then what are you waiting for? Peter selected a cool book with two Golden Age stories and one Silver Age story, DC Special number 14, Wanted, the World's Most Dangerous Villains. It stars the Toyman, the Penguin, Captain Cold, and includes the first appearance of Heatwave. It's a great comic book, and Peter is a great podcaster, so I'm sure you will enjoy it. Plus, don't forget, we'll have the first segment of Catch You Later Calculator with my Bat Brother, Sean M. Myers. So look for that on Sunday, January 4th. So now let's get to your comments about our last episode, DC Special Cast number 11, Danger Dinosaurs at Large, with my guest Martin Gray. As always, the best place to leave comments is on our website at fireandwaterpodcast.com. First up, Rob McCarthy says, number one, before we even start, Captain Comet and Martin Gray? Deep. Two, the Daredevil bad guy, Gladiator, had been around for ages by 77, so that may be the reason why they changed Gladiator, but there may be another reason. In the 70s, every freaking fanzine article said, you know, the novel Gladiator inspired Superman. Good point, Rob. Three, my favorite thing about the Secret Society was in number two, Grodless, L, the Alien Invasions comet had stopped, and Hal Jordan didn't know. And number four, in Secret Society of Supervillains, they make it clear that the JLA doesn't really want Captain Comet. Thanks, Rob. Next up, Ito Bosnar says, another one of those specials I never had, but I always wanted, because I do recall seeing it in the house ads. It just never showed up at any of my local spinner racks. Not only was I a big dinosaur kid, although who wasn't, but I also loved Captain Comet based on the two or three issues of the Secret Society of Supervillains that I did own. Back then, I always wondered why he wasn't a bigger deal, and yes, why he wasn't a member of the Justice League. I thought he was so darn cool. And based on your gallery post, a further regret at never having had this issue is the art. I'm also a fan of Buckler's, and Rubenstein's inks make it look so lovely. Speaking of lovely art, it's great that you got to meet JLGLPBHN and snap some photos with him. We really have to treasure these opportunities to meet these creators while they're still around. Yeah, more than just a few or just one photo. Sean took my phone and took about 100 photos like every half a second. Thanks, Ito. Take care. Next up, Super Captain said, another great show. Paul, Martin Gray is an international treasure and always welcome on any Fire and Water podcast. That's the way we think, Super Captain. I like dinosaurs, but not quite as much as intelligent gorillas. Yes, I am the target demographic that Julie Schwartz had in mind. I've never read this comic, but I knew Captain Comet quite well from Secret Society of Supervillains. In fact, at age six or so, I think I thought he might have been a villain who turned over a leaf due to his involvement in that title. It would be interesting to see someone at DC build on his membership in the Justice Alliance, introduced in that new history of the DC Universe, a team that existed between the JSA and the JLA that included Prince Rahman, Auto Man, Tiger Man, and everybody's favorite Golden Ape Kong Gorilla. I've also enjoyed Captain Comet's recent guest appearances, Mark Waid's Action Comics. It's cool to see you meeting with JLGLPABHN. He was very kind and gracious a few years ago when I met him. I think I'm one of the few fans who asked him to sign a copy of Doctor Strange Fate from the Amalgam Universe. That's a cool choice, Super Captain. When I first met him years ago, my choice was my beat-up copy of Batman vs. the Hulk, which I still treasure. Rob Kelly, Grand Poobah of the Fire and Water Network, says, a note to Martin re-getting a Robbie. Start watching MASH. I was never a dinosaur kid, so I'm sure this issue wouldn't have resonated with me if I saw it on the newsstand. I admire DC's willingness to let Captain Comet lead the story since he was never a big seller. For whatever reason, when I think of Tommy Tomorrow, I don't think of any comic he's ever been in. Rather, his appearance in a Hembeck special, where he commiserates with the Martian Manhunter about their perennial backup feature status. As a kid, I was tickled at the notion of some characters being stars, while others were background players like they were actors. Looking forward to next month. I can guarantee one of the segments is going to be awesome. And indeed it was, Rob. Ryan really knocked it out of the park. Thanks, Rob. Movie Matt Saroy says, "This comic proves that the dinosaurs were indeed destroyed by a comet. Captain Comet. I'm fairly certain Danger Dinosaurs at large is an actual alert in most cities and the DCU. My only question is how seriously the citizens take it. Do they take it like a Midwestern tornado warning and seek shelter and hunker down until the all clear? Or do they treat it like a nor'easter in New England and ignore it at their own peril? Either way, I'm sure there are a few people who panic, run to the store, and buy 5 gallons of milk and 12 loaves of bread." Matt, when I read your comment, I thought of the scene in Superman where the kaiju comes out and all the people are around taking pictures instead of running. Back to Matt. This is a great episode about a great comic. I will buy a comic with a dino on the cover over an ape any day. Who doesn't like dinosaurs? Well, maybe people who've had their arms bitten off by them. Thanks, Matt. Bucky749 was next. He said, "You will have a new listener as my brother the Iceman asked me to download your podcast." Well, welcome aboard, Iceman. Another great episode. Look forward to what next. It's too bad there never was a DC special hosted by Vincent Price and Jonah Hex. Well, that would have been something, Buck. Next up, past guest Dr. Ange said, quote, "Howard Chaykin was the Tom King of his generation. As a huge fan of Chaykin and a strong disliker of King, that felt like a shiv in the ribs." Sorry, Ange. What I liked about Twilight was that Chaykin took very little-known space characters for that time, Tommy Tomorrow, Star Rover, Space Cabbie, and put them in a dystopian future. Even Brent is there. Definitely worth a read. Ange, I have to say, I pulled out my old trade of that a couple years ago and read it, and it just really wasn't my cup of tea. I loved American Flag, too, and the art was fantastic, but Twilight, for some reason, just didn't catch me. To each their own. Anyway, back to Ange. For this episode, fun issue. Feels like DC wanted Comet to be something, given the SSOV starring role in the dinosaur issue. He never quite made it, though, did he? So much fun. Who knew Kronos could be such a wily villain? Right? I think this is like the most interesting Kronos ever was. I wanted to know more about how he got all those powers. Thanks a lot, Ange. Anyway, now next up is Chuck Dill, who said, "Wonderful episode, Paul. Always a delight to hear Martin Gray talk about collecting comics as a kid. I went through an SSOSV Captain Comet phase when I first shipped off to college back in 1988. I couldn't handle all the many changes my life had been through, and I hit the back issue bins to fill a hole in my soul. That's where I got this thoroughly enjoyable issue. I was low-key rooting for Comet's JLA membership, even though I already knew it would never happen. He does show up in at least one JLA pinup I can think of. Green Arrow without a beard? Why? That's a childhood comic for me. What Rob Kelly would classify as a mountain comic. I read and reread and read again in the back of my parents' 1977 Vista Cruiser station wagon as we moved from Texas to upstate New York. Love this issue, and I think this is where I fell in love with Black Canary. Why did he shave it? To disguise himself as a guard. Did it work? No. Because of this cover, I always thought it was a much bigger deal than it was. That's a great story, Chuck. Thanks for sharing. And Martin Gray agreed. Oh, my word, Chuck. Thank you. The last mystery of the 70s solved. I must seek this issue out. And the modern answer man, our bat nephew, Isamu, added, fun fact, Green Arrow used his razor arrow to shave his beard in that story. And the razor arrow was actually one of those few regular arrows that Green Arrow carried in his quiver, which had a regular arrowhead, though it was razor sharp. Thanks, guys. That was a great story. Next up, Fire and Water All-Star Chris Franklin commented. He said, fun show, Paul and Martin. I remember seeing this cover back in the ads, but I really had no idea what it was about, other than it was Captain Comet fighting dinosaurs. Heck, I thought the purple-clad guys at the cover's bottom were two of the challengers of the unknown, Ace and Rocky. It sounds like a fun story, and I applaud DC for trying to do something with these older characters and also appeal to the general kids love dinosaurs rule. In the late 70s, early 80s, Mego did a promotion contest where they had free posters in stores to promote their world's greatest superheroes line. Superman, Batman, Robin, and Wonder Woman were shown fighting dinosaurs, probably because Mego already had cut all the villains out of the line at this point. I guess you could retcon the events that those posters took place during this special. I love that, Chris. Speaking of toys, yes, I do have that Batman alarm clock. Still have the one from my childhood, even though Batman and Robin went silent decades ago. Cindy and I also have a couple of the Super Babies dolls, Superman and Wonder Woman. These dolls and their placement in ads in DC books led to the creation of the Super Juniors merchandising push, which resulted in a comic that was first printed in foreign markets, and then finally in a DC Digest in the 80s here in the US. Yeah, Chris, I still think they're a little creepy, sorry. I also see my beloved Batman from Alfred to Zowie book there too. Great stuff. Awesome stuff, Chris. Thanks for sharing. And then there was a great chat between Isamu and Martin, some of which was repeated on Blue Sky, but I'll read the comments that were here on the network website. Isamu starts off and said, "Fun show, gentlemen. Uncle Martin, I do not believe Tyranno Rex made another appearance in DC Comics, though Neer Adams may have ran with the idea in his Continuity Comics Ms. Mystic title, in which the controversial heroine discovered a land of anthropomorphic intelligent dinosaurs ruled by an intelligent T-Rex named, well, T-Rex. And Neil Adams originally drew the Superman head swiped on the last page for Justice for All Children's PSA number 2. Isamu made the same comment in Blue Sky, and he included the image. Wow, it was really spot on. It's like Buckler just traced it, if it was Buckler that drew it. Back to Isamu. The Paul Levitz and Bob Rozakis caricatures were illustrated by Mad Magazine cartoonist Dave Manack in 1976. They were originally created for issue 13 of The Amazing World of DC Comics fanzine, in a feature titled Inside the Amazing World, which was essentially a rundown of the fanzine staff. The feature also included caricatures by Mr. Manack of Carl Gafford, Nislin Bridwell, Jack C. Harris, Anthony Tolland, John Workman, Steve Mitchell, and Shelley Iber. I'll post these characters on Blue Sky so you can have a look and discover that both characters were reversed in the story behind the story. Again, thanks, Isamu. Listeners, check out Blue Sky if you want to see those images. More wonky anatomy can be seen in panel 3 of page 19, where it appears Kronos' left leg was overextended so it would not be obscured by the word balloon. The only other instance I know of involving a left leg extension to make room for text was the famous Kryptonite Nevermore cover for Superman 233. I wonder, though, if this story had taken place between Secret Society of Supervillains 5 and 6, even though it was released between 6 and 7. To which Martin Gray replied, "Super insights and comments as ever, Isamu. Thanks." I wonder what Neil said to Rich, because he certainly would have said something. Maybe they were pals. I think they were pals, Martin. Remember, they worked at Continuity together for at least some time. And Martin said, "I wonder if the left leg in 233 is one of the reasons Neil Adams hated the image. It's funny. I've never even noticed the wonkiness." Also added, "I'd never read Miss Mystic. All I've seen is that cover with her standing in front of our big blue marble." And finally, Isamu the Modern Answer Man left a few more comments. He said, "Neil Adams pointed out the wonkiness as one of the reasons in this 13th Dimension interview." And of course, he left a link for that. "And I posted the Ms. Mystic T-Rex page on Blue Sky. So now you can say you see two things in Ms. Mystic's, Martin. And my dad collected Ms. Mystic and all the Continuity Comics titles, mostly for the Adams and Adams-esque artwork, although he did admit he liked only a few of the stories. I'm with your dad there, Isamu. I had some of the early Ms. Mystic when they first came out, but they were never really my cup of tea, nor, of course, did they come out on any kind of a regular basis." And then finally, Isamu ends up, "I remember seeing some of those Continuity Comics in my dad's collection, but he never let me look at them, telling me I had to wait till I was older. Having discovered them as I sorted through his personal effects, I discovered that many issues tend to have more graphic blood and gore violence than other superhero comics of the time, though definitely mild compared to comics today. What's funny is that many of these graphically violent comics included a full-page advertisement for Continuity Comics titles with the header, 'Your kids can't read television.'" Thanks for the great info, Bat Nephew Isamu. Take care. Next up, we have Gothos Mansion, who says, "I was only 6 years old when this comic came out. I guess I was lured in by the dinosaurs. At that point, I rarely bought comics that didn't feature a hero I was already familiar with, and I didn't know anyone in this issue. I was already watching Godzilla movies on Saturday morning. DC must have thought dinosaurs or dragons had some life in them. I'm kind of going by the Superman, Batman, Jigsaw puzzle that shows them fighting a fire-breathing dinosaur. Since Jaws was still popular, Superman also did a Superman versus Shark Jigsaw puzzle. It's still one of my favorite Superman images. Gorillas were probably more in the zeitgeist than dinosaurs at the time due to the 1976 King Kong movie. Superheroes versus Super Gorillas was my gateway drug. It was one of the first comics purchases I discovered after reruns of the Batman TV series. What kids didn't want to see Batman fight a giant gorilla? Anyway, that comic was my discovery of Superman and the Flash. I became a fan of the both." Those are great comics, Gothos Mansion. Certainly on the list for DC Special Cast, although no one has requested it yet. It's a weird one since it was a one-shot, although there was a similar earlier DC special with the same title, Superheroes vs. Super Gorillas, that Martin has already put his name in for when his turn comes around again. Back to Gothos Mansion, the Batman baby doll and alarm clock were available in either the JCPenney, Sears, or Spiegel Christmas catalogs. My mom got both for me, and that was where she got a lot of my Batman stuff. Oh, that alarm clock went off at almost any time, except for whatever time it was set for. I think it helped develop preparedness since it always went off when I wasn't expecting it. Don't get it the wrong idea. I loved it, and I still have it. Weirdly, the Batman simplicity pattern costume only had a hood and not a mask, just like the baby doll. My mom sewed a mask on my hood, so it looked a little more comic accurate. Yeah, right. And a little less like the baby doll costume. Those are great stories, Gothos Mansion. Thank you very much for sharing them.
Next up, our pal Sphinx Magoo says, what a fun episode. It was like a fun Venn diagram of interest for me in one comic book. Here we have Captain Comet, who I enjoyed in SSOSV, Dinosaurs, Kronos, one of my favorite Silver Age villains, and Tommy Tomorrow. I was first introduced to Tommy Tomorrow from the reprinted story in Superman Family, where Tommy met Supergirl in the 21st century. A fun story, which I hope you'll cover in the possibly upcoming Superman Family podcast? Yeah, keep hoping, Sphinx. Anyway, I want to give a shout out to Bob Rozakis, who seemed to carve out his own little corner of the DC universe to play in. With Secret Society, the Freedom Fighters, the Teen Titans, the Airwave backups and Action Comics, and the mini series in Detective Comics, which introduced the Calculator, Bob Rozakis was one of my favorite creators of DC back in the day. His stories were always fun, and your recaps of his stories here and in the Batman Family Reunion podcast only helped increase my fondness for his stories. Thanks, that's really nice of you to say, Sphinx. We love Bat Cousin Bob, too, and as we announced earlier, Sean and I will be covering that Calculator story starting next month. Back to Sphinx, he said, I want to bring attention to a little side project Bob Rozakis had. In 2011, Rozakis released The Secret History of AA Comics, the alternate Earth project, where it looked an alternate development for the Silver Age for All-American Comics. In our Earth Prime continuity, All-American Comics, of course, became absorbed into DC Comics. But in Bob's project, All-American Comics stood on its own, and that changed everything. Not only does the book describe some of the behind-the-scenes machinations in the AA offices, it also describes what the Silver Age would have looked like with the AA heroes were introduced to a modern audience. The detail made me wonder if Rozakis had been coming up with a proposal for a new alternate Earth for a JLA-JSA crossover. Definitely worth checking out. And Sphinx included a link to the Lulu print-on-demand site where you can purchase this. I seem to recall something about this being serialized in Back Issue and Alter Ego. I have all the back issues, but probably never got the Alter Ego. I'm tempted to pick up this collection and throw a few bucks at Cousin Bob. It's pretty cool, as I recall. Some of it was that he imagined what happens if the AA heroes, Green Lantern and Flash, were the ones that continued to be published in the 50s instead of Superman and Batman, and we got new versions of them instead. So I could have that wrong, but I seem to have a vague recollection of that. So I think I'm going to check that out. Back to Sphinx. Oh, and one last thing. I think that one reason Captain Comet was passed up for JLM membership was his costume choice of tighty whities on the outside of his jumpsuit. Plus, they had lightning bolts on them. Holy awkward fashion statement, Batman. Thank you for the great episode and podcast. I look forward to future episodes. Thank you, Sphinx. Great comments. And Martin added, thanks, Sphinx. Looks like we're of a similar generation. So if you were to do one of these shows, what DC special would you pick? If I were running the JLA, tighty whities would be compulsory. Well, unless a really scary menace was due. And Sphinx answered Martin, said, I believe we are of the same generation, Martin. I'm old enough to have purchased many of these DC Special Series issues when they were first released. Hey, join the club, Sphinx. As for which one would I pick, how could I choose just one? I mean, of the issues that we haven't covered yet, one, the original Swamp Thing series were my intro into the great Len Wein Bernie Wrightson series, so foundational for what would come later and an absolute delight. And there are three issues to choose from. Number two, Wanted, the World's Most Dangerous Villains. Two issues to choose from, and they were the pilot issues from my favorite reprint series of the 70s. E. Nelson Bridwell knew his costume villains and helped future DC writers tap into DC's long history. Well, you'll be happy next month, Sphinx. Three, the Viking Prince issue. Just look at that cover. Absolutely gorgeous and gorgeous on the inside. Agree, Sphinx. The World's Finest Comics Digest, just to be able to talk about the composite Superman. Five, Batman vs. the Incredible Hulk, just to be able to talk about this delightful crossover, which I think is my most favorite of the crossovers. So yeah, I don't know. Well, Sphinx, if you or anybody else wants to give podcasting a try, just send me an email at DC Specialcast and I can get you signed up for one of those issues. Moving on, Network All star and host of the Fantastic Four, Brett Young, says, great show, Paul and Martin. Although, I was really expecting more sports talk from you, Martin. To which Martin replied that he was saving all his sporty chat for the Fantastic Four. I'd never seen or heard of the special before, so it was really fun to see it on DC Ultra so I could read it. Such an odd story. The dinosaur man wearing a leotard and seemingly jazzercising when Comet and the scientists come upon him was certainly an interesting choice. And those pages you posted of Captain Comet and Kronos do look like Gil Kane's work from the poses to the up-nose shot. The only thing missing were lips on the dinosaur. All in all, fun show as always. Thank you, Brett. And last but not least, the fire half of the network poobahs, Shag, posted the following. Hi, Paul. Forgive the late comment, but I'm playing catch-up on some podcasts, and I figured it made more sense to leave this note here. I just finished the excellent episode on Enemy Ace with your guest, Captain Entropy. I absolutely loved that discussion. As always, the captain brings such enthusiasm and sharp commentary, and his military insight was fascinating. No argument there, Shag, and it was great to meet you both in person, finally, in Baltimore. Back to Shag. He said, it was exciting to hear you spotlight such a beloved and often overlooked character like Academy ace. I missed him growing up, but after hearing so many fans rave about the series, I picked up the Showcase Presents Enemy Ace volume when it came out some 17 years ago now. Oh my gosh, those series are phenomenal. First, you've got Robert Kaniger's compelling war narratives, always a treat, which you saw for yourselves when you read some of the stories for this episode. Second, since it's a Showcase Presents, you get Joe Kubert's stunning artwork in black and white, which really lets you focus on his exquisite line work. Just wow. I also perked up when you mentioned Balloon Buster. That name is basically my Pavlovian dinner bell. Not sure if you knew, but he actually became a semi-recurring foe for Enemy Ace. They clashed in Star-Spangled War Stories 181 to 183 from 1972, and again in Unknown Soldier 262 to 267 from 1982, which touched on some of that in the Balloon Buster Who's That episode back in 2021. Such fantastic comics. Yeah, somebody else mentioned that, and I was remiss in not bringing up Balloon Buster Shag, so thanks for pointing those particular issues out in case anybody wants to read them. Back to Shag. Also, you mentioned the 2008 miniseries The War That Time Forgot. I just want to plug for that series as well, as I adored it. It was a large-scale team-up of War Comics characters, dinosaurs, time travel, loads of fun. Right now, I'm working my way through your Secrets Origins of Superheroes episode and loving your and Brento 3000 discussion of Dr. Fate. The Good Doctor is a longtime favorite of mine, so this one's a real treat, too. Thanks again for the fantastic conversations. Sincerely, the irredeemable Shag, and he points out, quote, the only host on the Fire and Water Podcast Network who has yet to appear on the show. Yes, yes, I know. I've heard enough about this in Baltimore, but promise listeners, Shag will be on in 2026. Phew, that's it for the comments. A reminder, if you're enjoying what you hear on this show or any of the other network shows, please consider becoming a patron to help defray the costs. At certain levels, you can get a call out on the show of your choice or suggest an episode to the network. This episode's special thanks go out to our Sunday supporters, Al the Comics Guy, David Gutierrez, Gord Tolton, Mike Atchison. To find out more, go to patreon.com/FWpodcasts and thanks. That'll do it for the feedback section and for this episode. I hope you all enjoyed it. It was a lot of work, but super fun to be able to have such a great holiday celebration. My thanks again to the following Fire and Water All-Stars for appearing on this episode.
Ryan Daly.
Brett Young.
Rob Kelly.
Chris Franklin.
And of course, thanks to Sean M. Myers. It was great to be podcasting again with my bat brother. I'm looking forward to the Monthly Planet and Catch You Later Calculator starting next month. Thanks for listening, and I hope you will join me and Peter Watson in the new year as we cover Wanted, the world's most dangerous villains.